This meeting of the House Resources Committee will now come to order. It is now 1:08 p.m. Friday, April 17, 2026, in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Fields, Representative Colomb, Representative Hall, Representative Mears, Representative Prox, Representative Sadler, Co-Chair Representative Dibert, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Freer. Excuse me. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole from Records and Renzo Moises from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. Today, we have Mr. Nick Fulford of Gaffney Klein back before the committee to address unanswered questions from our hearing on April 1st. And then we will be taking up amendments for House Bill 321, Fish and Game Wildlife Refuge, from Representative Andy Josephson. Mr. Fulford, if you can hear me, please put yourself on record and begin your overview.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just doing a quick sound check, make sure you can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you.
Excellent. So for the record, my name is Nicholas Fulford, Senior Director of Gas and LNG at Gaffney Klein. So if you wish, Madam Chair, I can go through the questions individually and pause for additional discussion in between them.
Yes, please. That would be great.
Okay. Thank you. So the first unanswered question, which I think related to the hearing on April the 1st, was a question from Representative Fields around equity stakes for municipalities and the state. So in broad terms, these are particularly common in Asia, certainly outside the US more typically, but they are seen as a key implementation measure for LNG projects by many host governments for a variety of reasons. Clearly, there's a sense of equilibrating the value between the international oil and gas companies and the host nation. And secondly, it's seen as a way to generate long-term value for the host country. A lot of the discussion around these equity shareholdings often revolves around the way in which they're paid for. Because, clearly, for the Alaska LNG project, for example, a 25% shareholding, which is what the state is technically entitled to, would be a multi-billion dollar investment. So for a number of host governments, the equity is often done through what's called a carry, whereby the international oil and gas companies who sponsor the project hold the equity, which is then paid for out of future revenues. So the transition of equity from the project sponsors to the government takes place over a period of time. The other important thing to consider, of course, is that by taking equity in the project, you're to some extent also sharing the commercial risks that are part and parcel of an LNG project like this. That's why, typically the returns on these projects can be, around 10-11%, that sort of order for LNG infrastructure at least. So it's a relatively high level of return in government terms, but it does bring with it certain risks. So for example, if you look internationally at where these risks arise, for the Australian experience, for example, a lot of that risk arose really because of capital cost escalation between FID and conclusion of the project. Occasionally, there have been challenges to do with gas resources. Clearly in Alaska, that's highly unlikely to be the case. And perhaps more commonly, it's often a function of disruption in LNG markets. So it could be regulatory change in the buying countries. It could be some kind of government action outside the host nation that undermines the sort of contractual solidity of the project. So it's worth bearing in mind that that there are these risks that go with equity. Another very frequent discussion point comes around the way in which dividends are organized and paid. For government investors, typically long-term stability, lack of volatility around dividends is quite important for all sorts of planning purposes. So sometimes the way in which dividends are split between government shareholders and oil and gas companies, it can be a little bit different. So sometimes, for example, a preference share arrangement can be introduced, which provides the government entity with a more level series of incomes rather than the more volatile income that would arise from taking gas price risk, for example. So clearly within the discussions that have taken place between AGDC and Glenfarne about the 25% entitlement that the state has, it's highly unlikely, I think, that a lot of these details would have been discussed or gone into in any kind of detail. But as the discussion around the project progresses, it's something which I think is likely to come up on the agenda at some point. A good example I wanted to highlight for the committee comes from Papua New Guinea. So the first PNG LNG project was developed around 10 years ago. Sponsors were Exxon and the company that became Santos. So a lot of time and trouble was put into discussing an appropriate split of revenues and equity with the communities that were impacted by the project. It came in two forms. One was a direct financial benefit, sort of akin to the purpose of property tax in Alaska. And then the other was through equity. So the way in which the funds were allocated, some of it was a direct cash payment to the communities involved. Some of it went into a sort of infrastructure fund. And then around a third of it went into a sort of future generations sort of rainy day fund, if you like, for the benefit of the community many years hence. So for that example, the total state equity involvement was 19.4%, not so different to the 25% that is being talked about here. And of that, the local communities that were impacted by the project more directly took just over a 4% equity stake. So the quick answer is that equity by government and or affected communities is very frequently a feature of LNG projects, but the way in which it can be organized depends on the kind of unique features. So I'll pause there because I'm sure there are some questions involved.
Thank you, Mr. Fulford. First question, or first up in the queue, is Representative Fields, then Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair. This is great context. I just want to note for committee members, Ledge Legal, I did ask Ledge Legal about an equity stake in exchange for foregone property tax revenue, and Ledge Legal advises that that is a potentially viable way to take an equity stake in this project, and that closely resembles the carry structure that you described, if I'm hearing you correctly.
Thank you, Representative Fields. It's through the chair. I think this sort of ebb and flow of equity versus taxation, it is quite a common feature that you see in these projects. And just coming back to my comment about revenue stabilization, there are two ways of doing that. One is to do it directly with taxes, with variable taxes, depending on the profitability in the project. And the other is through equity. So I just wanted to add that point.
Thank you, Mr. Fulford. Did you have a follow-up, Representative Fields? Okay, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Mr. Fulford, your commentary, as usual, was very dense and full of facts and full of implications. They're not simple concepts to grasp, and the implications for how we craft this legislation are immense. So I would love to have any documentation of what you've just told us about equity and carried risks and dividends and direct cash benefits and so forth. So I'm going to kind of go backwards in the topics you raised, speaking of how the Papua New Guinea LNG project provided direct financial benefits to the communities. You ran through some stuff real quick. I would like to ask you to repeat those, and I'm going to have some questions about how they were scaled. You described some concepts, but you just touched on the high points. There's some details I need to ask you, but could you please repeat your section on that?
Yes, thank you, Representative Sadler, and through the chair. I think the key features of the PNG arrangement, which I think is really the most advanced and highly negotiated framework, which involves both state government and individual communities. It was split up into two features. First of all, there was a royalty applied to the gas based on the value of the wellhead. So that royalty was quite separate from the equity. 2% royalty allocated 40% as cash to affected communities, 30% to an investment sort of community infrastructure fund, and 30% to what they call the Future Generations Fund. So that 2% royalty was split 40-30-30 in that manner. Then the other element of compensation reward, call it what you will, for affected communities was the opportunity to acquire an equity stake in the project. That there was an initial allocation of equity stake, I think it was 2.7%, with an option for communities to add to that if they wished. The interesting thing with the PNG example is that it wasn't a carry function. Basically, the equity had to be funded directly up front by the communities. So in that example, the state government stepped in and helped with enabling the local communities to fund that equity.
I'm sorry, when you say enable them to, gave them the money to?
Essentially, a lot of the funding, you know, in the end, originates from future revenues. So it's a kind of a bridging loan, call it what you will, against future revenues.
So to feedback, so the state lent them the money to a front.
I think it's a simpler way of putting it, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that was about it, really. As I say, the interesting statistic, 19% state interest, and of that, 4.25% ended up being owned by the sort of local communities and governments along the scope of the project. So the numbers aren't dissimilar. The 19's not so dissimilar from 25. So, you know, if you took that as an analog, you could say, well, 5% for the boroughs. That's, you know, many, many other things go into that rather than just simply a proportion. But if you were to replicate that approach, that's what it would end up as.
Thank you. And follow up, please.
Follow up,
Mr.
Representative Sandler.
So you said in the end it was 19% state equity, and was that 4.25% of the equity the communities held part of that 19%, or was that an additional?
Yes, through the chair, that was part of the 19.4.
Okay, great. Okay, and then another question for you is, did you say one of the two methods by which there would be direct equity investment was a 50% royalty? I want to make sure that you described how that was 40-30-30 divided. What was the royalty rate or level you said?
The original pot of money, so to speak, was a 2% royalty at the wellhead.
2% royalty, okay.
Based on that kind of calculated netback value.
Netback. Okay, very good. That's enough follow-up. You have many more questions to pick up in a while. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Fulford. 2% royalty is part of the equation. What was the wellhead value of the gas-ish?
That's an excellent question, Representative Mears, through the chair. I think for a rough approximation, you could probably use $1.50, maybe $2. I'm just guessing there, but that's typically how it would end up. If you take Asian realized LNG prices, less the cost of the infrastructure, it might have been a little bit more in that case, but that'll give you a rough idea.
I just wanted to say that's in the neighborhood of what we're talking about. So if that wellhead value was significantly more, 2% would have a very different ring to it than looking at something that's on a similar scale. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. And moving upstream again, Mr. Fulford, you talked about the royalty. The PNG project was among the most highly negotiated, and that's interesting to know. One of the negotiated areas was dividing a 2% wellhead royalty among cash to communities, a community infrastructure fund, and a rainy day fund. That, to me, goes to the question of how a natural gas pipeline project is going to affect municipalities, local communities in the state, which is an area we have yet to get determination on. So I'd like to know more about how much money that 40-30-30 split out, and was that actually part of any legislation, or was that a contractual agreement that was reached between the parties?
Thank you, Representative Sadler. I would have to check back to see whether it was contractual or legislative, but I suspect it would have been the latter. And perhaps just to add context as well to the PNG example, it was very carefully thought out in immense detail, as you can see from the way in which it was set up to work. Not surprisingly, there were a number of discussions after the event in terms of whether the allocation of funds was appropriate, whether the funding was going to the right people. So inevitably, in a project of this size, when you're talking about significant impacts on local communities, it's very hard to formulate an equation which everyone is content with. So it's just maybe another good example that a lot of work went into it, but a number of stakeholders felt that it was not the right outcome.
Right. And
follow up.
And that speaks to one of my significant concerns about the project we're engaged with in Alaska right now, is that these impacts to the communities are happening out of our view. And if we're going to use some other LNG projects as models for how the Alaska project should happen, and those other projects included legislative provisions for impact aid and cash to communities, we need to get information quickly about those negotiations to see how we need to sculpt these carefully negotiated aspects into our legislation. That's really important to me. And I think also in an earlier presentation to us, you spoke of the recognition that sometimes conditions change over decades and that there is some provision for renegotiating terms of the long-term LNG contract. And I guess I'd like to expound on that a little bit more and what that might mean for the Alaska project.
Thank you, Representative Sadler, through the chair. It is very common for various features of an LNG project to be revisited following FID, following construction, etc. And in fact, on the selling side of the equation, because over the decades that LNG has been growing as a commodity, from time to time, very significant changes happen which have a fundamental impact on the sale and purchase agreement. So for the last 10, 15 years maybe, all LNG sale and purchase contracts, they typically have some kind of reopener. Sometimes it's called a material adverse change clause, MAC clause. Sometimes it's purely driven by changes in price. Occasionally, an indexation feature of the price is discontinued, so you have to sit down. So there are mechanisms, even on the sales side, to sit down and kind of reformulate things between buyer and seller within a very constrained environment, I have to say. It's not just a let's start afresh. And similar thing happens with host governments. And, you know, for example, this could happen if additional oil and gas resources are found, which can be routed through the same facilities at some later date. If the project is expanded in some form. And then, of course, you know, in the context of Alaska, you know, one of the things I've talked about before, which is often a primary feature of the host government dialogue in some other places, is this question of domestic market obligation or domestic supply obligation. So that's often a very carefully negotiated part of the host government agreement, which is present here as well. So, you know, that's another area where changes or developments could affect things in the future.
May I follow up on that, please?
Before we follow up, Representative Sadler, I just want to note that we have Dan Stickle on the line as well from the Department of Revenue, and also to note that we are still on the first question out of Representative Fields 3, and then you had 4 questions, and we've got about a half an hour left with Mr. Fulford before we move on to the presentation.
I don't have more questions.
Okay. Oh, well, I mean, in your...
Oh, I see these. That
he's going through is the questions that he's going through.
Fair enough.
But, and I also, recognizing the number of amendments that we've received for House Bill 321, the intent is after this meeting, there's another committee. LNC meets after us. We'll come if we have not gone through all of the amendments, we'll come back after at 5:30 to resume resources. So, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that and appreciate you laying out that timeline. Given the importance, we have an amendment deadline for this gas
Absolutely.
Bill. So I think it's important to raise these questions. I appreciate the chance to scooch other issues off towards the end. And I hope if we do come back on gas line, we have Mr. Fulford available for us later.
Absolutely.
So the question I have still in my mind is the reopening. You said very plainly that it's common to have features to basically to reopen the conditions of a gas line project. Have you can provide us any kind of template language or that other companies, other projects have used? Because as of right now, I see no provision in the gas line bill before us to allow for renegotiation of these conditions. So unless I'm looking around the table and seeing anyone else has seen evidence of that, I'm not seeing it. And my concern is, for the record, that we lock ourselves into conditions over 30 years, but we're passing by the opportunity to have a reopener. So that in 10, 15, 20 years, 30 years, we might find ways we should renegotiate this for the benefit of Alaskans. So that's very, very interesting to me and very, very important part of legislation. So if you can provide, again, any templates or sample or information about those renegotiations, I'd be very helpful. To me.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Through the chair, just a very quick comment on that one. On the sales side, it's a contractual relationship between two private parties. Obviously, the discretion exercised by government is very different in the sense that government can take action on a whole host of features without necessarily the cooperation of the other parties involved. So it is a little bit different, but very happy to provide that context around, you know, when LNG contracts are typically revisited and for what reasons.
Yeah. Thank you. I think it's important for this committee members to understand the implications of that.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Mr. Fulford.
Okay. Given your comments about timing and so forth, Madam Chair, both Representative Fields' questions and Representative Sadler's questions, they address the question of economic analysis and the open book economic model. And I know you have Mr. Stickle on the phone. I've listened to his testimony over the last few days and weeks. And clearly, DOR has presented an array of very helpful numbers to help understand the economics of the project and the taxable benefits. And I think having heard that commentary, and my understanding is that AGDC have assisted in how that model has come together, at least in terms of the mechanics of the model. Perhaps not so much the assumptions that go into it. So, you know, as we talk about an open book economic model, my impression certainly is that the work that DOR have done with the input from AGDC is sort of approaching this kind of concept, and you know, is potentially forming a foundation for this discussion around the economics, and therefore the ability of the project to support various taxes and government take mechanisms. So I just put that out there as a comment, that I think, you know, the work that DOR is doing does seem to be heading towards this concept of an open book model.
Thank you, Mr. Fulford. So, I don't see any questions or comments, so if you want to proceed with the rest of the questions.
Okay. Thank you, Jeffrey. So I think that probably largely concludes the questions that Representative Fields had posed. I think we've probably touched on most of those. Representative Sadler asked about the 1% inflation index on the alternative volumetric tax. So I have done some numbers on this, and if we assume a 2% inflation rate, then after 10 years, because the AVT is only inflating at 1%, what would have been a nominal $65 million per annum that would be generated by using money per day, that would reduce to about $60 million in real terms after 10 years. So after 35 years, the 1% fixed inflation versus a 2% assumption, it would have fallen to about $47 million in real terms. And cumulatively, after 35 years, it would be $2.23 billion in nominal terms, but $1.96 billion in real terms. So that gives you a sense of what might happen. I know this has been discussed in other forums as well, and certainly in my experience, it would be unusual to see a fixed escalation number like that in perpetuity. Typically, there would be some kind of indexation applied such that it would keep the numbers more in line with what's happening around them. So hopefully that adds some context to the question that was asked.
Thank you. Representative Sadler?
Briefly, Mr. Fulford, if you could provide those, I was taking notes like a banshee. If you had that written or in a chart, I can see that would make it much more useful. Thanks.
I will send that. Thank you.
And Representative Fields?
Through the chair, just for clarity, Mr. Fulford, what you're saying is that rather than a fixed number, it's more common to have it linked to like CPI. Is that what you're saying?
That would be a typical way of doing it, particularly since there's no time limitation at all on these numbers. So, you know, exchange rates, inflation rates, as we all know, these can be very volatile.
Okay.
And it could create this kind of inadvertent disconnect between how the AVT was intended to operate and how it does operate.
Thank you.
Yeah. So the next question I have on the written responses, I think, is the question from Representative Sadler about whether LNG projects get tax relief. I think a more appropriate way of sort of answering that question, if you like, is that, you know, pretty well without exception, all major LNG projects have a tailor-made, a negotiated fiscal package around them, which, you know, often does include tax holidays or abatements in some areas, but also can include, you know, additional taxes in others. And, you know, we've spoken several times about this sort of iterative dialogue with the project developers to ascertain really how profitable the project is, what the appropriate rates of return are, and therefore what the kind of sustainable government take could be under different scenarios. And for that, you typically do get this dialogue around the kind of economic model. That's not to say that everyone's using the same assumptions, but that's typically the tool that's used for that type of dialogue.
Madam Chair.
Representative Sadler.
I'm embarrassed to say, Mr. Fulford, I'm not, I would like and appreciate if you would restate the question that you're part of the answer to. It might help me. It's a lot of questions. I want to make sure which one this one was.
Yeah. The reference, through the chair, the reference is Representative Sadler would like to know if all other LNG projects get tax relief.
Gotcha. And the answer is yeah. And AVT is one such?
Exactly. I think what perhaps you're discovering, this dialogue we're having now, is helping to expand on it. But the degree of complexity and detail around these projects and how they function, and the multifaceted way that they impact on communities, tax, and so forth, they typically have, you know, months of dialogue and negotiation to get to this kind of very granular equation of tax framework and returns for the developer.
And if I could
follow up
question here, I guess I'd pivot from Mr. Fulford to Mr. Stickle online. Have there been such months of negotiation on the tax issues regarding the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline project? Mr. Stickle?
Mr. Stickle, did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. To the chair, this is Dan Stickle, chief economist with the Department of Revenue. I would defer the details on those negotiations to AGDC. I don't know if they're online, but based on my understanding, yes, there have been discussions going on for months at least.
And we do not have AGDC on the line.
Fair enough. But I guess my question, Department of Revenue being the state's revenue taxation experts, you can tell me if there have been such negotiations from the DORs. You are doing it.
Through the chair, those discussions have been ongoing for months.
To put a fine point, no passive voice here. Has DOR been involved in tax negotiations with the AGDC?
Through the chair, DOR has been supporting those negotiations every step of the way. We've been doing modeling in support of Governor's Office and AGDC since last year.
And if I may, DOR has been supporting negotiations, and the negotiating parties are which?
Through the chair, I would defer the detailed discussions of those negotations to.
I'm not asking for details on the discussion, sir. I'm not asking for details on the discussion. I'm just asking DOR's involvement. And if you tell me that DOR has been supporting, certainly you know who the parties are. Who are the parties negotiating that you're supporting the negotiations of?
Sure. Through the chair, I'm aware of discussions with multiple municipalities, with AGDC, with Department of Revenue, with Governor's Office, and we've been supporting the state team every step of the way.
So municipalities, AGDC, and the Governor's Office. Correct? Mr. Stickle, so again, to confirm, you've been... I'm not sure if we have a technical problem. I just simply want to confirm. You say the negotiations are between municipalities, AGDC, and the Governor's Office. Those are the only parties, right?
Through the chair, I can't confirm that that's a comprehensive list. Like I said, we've been supporting. AGDC has been primarily leading the pipeline project on behalf of the state. We've been supporting every step of the way.
But you've been supporting them, but you're not sure who they were. Okay.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
Mr. Fulford, please proceed. And In consideration of time, I'm going to allow one follow-up, and then we can get back, you know, in the queue if there are any other questions. I don't see any other questions, but...
thank you, Chair Freer. So the next one I have on my list is, do other projects include impact aid to municipalities or states as part of the authorization or authorizing or enabling legislation? And as we've been discussing, yes, they do. It's a common feature within the lower 48, Texas, Louisiana. Typically lower rates, and certainly both those states, as you've heard from me before, operate typically a 10-year tax holiday for their. The municipality community supports in Canada typically much, much less. For example, it's less than $2 million a year Canadian in Kitimat. Peaks at around 10. So certainly funding for communities goes beyond compensating for the financial impact. And as we talked about with PNG, for example, it can include things like skills development, infrastructure investment, and so forth. So happy to comment on that more at some other occasion, but for now, perhaps leave it at that, unless there are any other questions. And then I think the last question was on the Excel model. And one more. So on the Excel model, as I mentioned before, and certainly listening to Mr. Stickle's testimony in this last few weeks, clearly there is a model within DOR which is relatively sophisticated. We're able to replicate the numbers using our model, which, you know, deals with the project in some detail, less so on the upstream, which I think the DOR model does deal with. And so that potentially is a good route to pursue the dialogue around economics and government take. The last question on my list was asking if there's a risk through locking in property taxes early before considering other policy levers. My comment on that would be replacing the property tax framework and mechanism with an alternative mechanism such as the alternate volumetric tax, which is more compatible with LNG economics. To me, that's a major step forward, which will help the project to progress discussions with lenders, sellers, etc. Whether the appropriate rate of tax is 6 cents is a harder one to ascertain, simply because I think even, you know, AGDC, you know, have indicated that they don't yet have accurate cost estimates for either the gas processing plant or the liquefaction. So without that, it's very hard to pin down a number which would survive the dialogue over the next months and years. So I think that would be my comment on that.
Representative Sather.
Well, thank you. I guess I'll ask this. We had talked about the 5 to 25% equity investment. I think I did hear from you, Mr. Fulford, earlier on that this deal, as currently conceived, would allow municipalities to invest as equity owners. I'm not sure if that is underneath the state's 5 to 25%, or if there's a separate provision for them. But a more important question, and I guess I'd like Mr. Stickle's perspective as well, is how does the state know what the right investment strategy is if we want to try to be carried for 5 to 25%? Should we spread our investment over all three elements? Should we emphasize one over the other? Mr. Fulford, if you have any perspective on how government has invested its equity, and then Mr. Stickle, if you've done any modeling or thoughts as to what the right equity investment strategy would be.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. I'll make a couple of initial comments on that. Of the various elements, the more complex one is the gas processing plant, because that will need to qualify for federal tax credits. And to do that, the ownership and framework for that corporate entity that owns that facility could be quite complicated, involving tax partnerships and so forth. That being the case, that element of the project may be less appropriate for state or thorough equity compared to the other two. But the pipeline and the liquefaction, they'd be typical candidates. So with that, I'll pass back to you.
Thanks.
Okay. Are there any further questions for Representative Sadler?
I didn't know if Mr. Stickle would want to weigh in on that same question.
Mr. Stickle.
Sure. Again, for the record, this is Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. So what we've done is we've modeled out under our baseline scenario the potential impacts of state investment and what that would look like in terms of cash outlay and return to the state. That's what I presented to the committee earlier this week. There would be potentially some justification for looking at the three components differently of the project. Phase one does, with the pipeline, does have a different sort of impact on potential in-state gas supply versus the other phases of the project. We would definitely want to have more concrete information around actual cost and project details beyond our baseline assumptions before making or recommending an investment decision. But we definitely have the ability to model various levels of state investment, and if there's any additional information beyond what we provided earlier this week, we'd be happy to assist.
Thank you. And just so you know, Representative Sadler, Mr. Matt Kissinger just joined the got on the line, so.
Great, I appreciate it. And if I may, Mr. Stickle, I appreciate hearing that. I'm glad to hear that, and knowing that we have a narrow six-month window to make investment decisions, I hope that you keep that plussed up and ready to educate us in the legislature as to how we should best make our allocations should we decide to make an equity investment. I think we'll be talking to each other more in the future, sir.
Are there any further questions? Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Kissinger, for joining us, Mr. Stickle for being here, and Mr. Fulford for coming back to the committee to address questions from April 1st. If there are any further questions, please submit them in writing to house.resources@akledge.gov, and we'll work on getting them answered for you. We'll likely ask Gaffney Klein to come back again in the very near future once we have a CS or amendments on 381. To consider any of the changes. With that, we will set House Bill 381 aside and move on to House Bill 321. The committee received 24 amendments for this bill before the amendment deadline previously set. I'm going to take a brief at ease as we transition to the next the next bill. on record in House Resources at 1:59 p.m. Next up on our agenda this afternoon is to move on to House Bill 321 and consider amendments. The amendment deadline was previously set. Representative Josephson, do you and your staff have any opening remarks before we begin your amendments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Andy Josephson, House District 13. With me is Joe Meehan, my staff. I don't really have any statements. Just as a reminder, this bill concerns reforming how we talk about, or in fact, what we call wildlife critical habitat areas, refuges, sanctuaries, and the like, and turns five titles, if you will, into wildlife sanctuaries and refuges, but keeping the purpose statement essentially the same by joining language where necessary. There's the boundary feature. There is regulations relating to the use of firearms, where firearms should be predominant, and where Fish and Game may want to foreclose firearm usage that is doing harm to the refuge. There's the Native Corporation land issue. We have a letter from Bristol Bay Native Association in support of the bill. There's the McNeil Sanctuary issue, the personal watercraft issue. Those are some of the key issues before you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Josephson. And just for the committee's awareness, Representative Elam is on the line now. And so I think we'll, now that he's on the line, we'll proceed with Representative Elam's amendment, as he may have some phone issues later. So, Representative Elam?
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you. I do have an amendment that I would like to move.
Oh. Okay. please move your amendment. And
am I speaking out of term?
No. You have amendment number 23, if you'd like to move that.
Yes, I would like to move amendment number 23 to House Bill 321.
I will object for the purposes of discussion. Representative Elam, do you want to speak to amendment 23?
Thank you. Yes. Basically, what my amendment does is it really kind of strips back some of the additional works that are being done there and really focuses the bill on specifically the map line and the plot course corrections that needed to be taken up. And so then it kind of takes away some of the other material as far as changing regulations related to Ketchumak Bay or to some of the renaming of the boundaries of some of the other areas, and just kind of focuses in on specifically the map adjustments. And I appreciate the opportunity, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Elam. Representative Josephson?
Yes, Andy Josephson for the record, and I invite Mr. Meehan to add to what I'm going to say. But fundamentally, there are some important issues. For example, as I noted, I mentioned that currently Native Corporation land is, call it an inadvertence, call it not, but it's part of many of these boundaries. And so Native corporations are having to go to get permits from DFNG. That frankly are technically needed, but we're trying to dispense with. And so that's the kind of issue that would not be reformed if you just did the boundary adjustment, potentially at least. And then there's for example, we're providing at Dude Creek near Gustavus, we're providing more access because we're growing that boundary in the bill, and we want to make sure that people continue to have access. So that's a better example of how there might be some negative repercussion of expanding a boundary and not providing that sort of relief. And then there's all the other issues I noted in my opening statement about firearms and cleanup of debris and how to mitigate that by DFNG having the authority to say, look, of course you can use firearms, but don't use them in a makeshift target practice near a trailhead, that sort of thing. So while I appreciate Representative Elam's amendment, and it does accomplish an important part of the bill, it leaves a lot of things unanswered.
Would you like to add anything, Mr. Meehan?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Joe Meehan, staff to Representative Josephson. Just to briefly touch upon some of the points that Representative Josephson just pointed out with the target shooting, not only safety issues, but the contamination issues that it creates in a lot of these access areas, which over the decades the department and federal partners have spent significant sums of money trying to clean up lead contamination and dispose of that public safety hazard. The disruptions of shooting ranges such as at Rabbit Creek, it wouldn't give the department the authority to restrict downrange access there. Another kind of a highlighted thing that it wouldn't do is the amendment would not allow future acquired land to be automatically added to the refuge. So that means every time the department acquired a new parcel of land within an established boundary of a refuge, they'd have to come back to the legislature each time to request permission to start managing that land as if it were refuge. And then there's some of the public access issues. Our bill, which would be stripped out in this amendment, would remove the public access component, adding that to the purpose statements of these refuges and critical habitat areas. And then lastly, the private land issue that Representative Josephson brought up. It would retain fish and game jurisdiction over private lands, in not only Native Corporation lands, but any private land that's inside of a current critical habitat area.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. I thought I saw Representative Colom. Did you want to be in the queue?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Colom. And then Representative Prox.
Thank you, Chair. So I support the amendment because so when this bill was first presented, it was called a cleanup bill, a boundary bill. These were just some mistakes that were made that need to be cleaned up. The sponsor did mention, you know, that recategorizes two different titles, the refuge and the critical habitat. But, you know, some of the issues with taking these things out, these are use issues, target shooting, cleaning up the public access, the watercraft. These are way beyond just cleaning up boundaries. And so, and I know it's been mentioned before that if you had a boundary bill, you probably would have passed it with no amendments at all. But this has far-reaching implications. And to the native jurisdiction, so my recollection is that it's Pilot Point, Igigek, and Port Hyden. So I don't dispute that, you know, they shouldn't have to get permits from fish and game, but that's a pretty big change in jurisdiction. Now you're taking fish and game jurisdiction and returning it back to private hands. I'm not really opposed to that. But that, again, is not a boundary cleanup. That's a pretty big policy change. And so I like the amendment because it takes all that out. It allows the boundaries to stay the same. And I would say there's probably 10 different bills in this one bill that we could run to make these changes. But to put them all in one bill, I'm having a problem with. So I support the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Colom. Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you. Well, I guess a comment and maybe a question. So I share Rep. Colom's concern. Boundary changes are one thing, and then there are a number of separate bills. And doing everything in one bill just increases the risk of it not being passed further on down the line or the governor vetoing the whole bill. And somebody's inevitably not going to like something about something and draw big controversy. So my concern is if we don't separate all of the other things out, we risk getting absolutely nothing out of it. So therefore, I support the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Prox. Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to associate myself with the comments of my colleagues who just spoke before me. The bill originally came for us as a kind of a map cleanup, some inadvertent tweaks may be done to the boundaries, but it, more research and delving into the bill show there's many, many elements that do a lot of things. And just like Representative Prox said, the more rough edges, the more people are going to find a reason to object to it. One that Mr. Meehan just mentioned demonstrates my concerns about the bill overall is that under the rubric, under the auspices of changing a couple little tweaks along the borders of refugees and so forth, it seems to tilt the playing field and set several functions on automatic pilot towards expanding refuges of whatever nomenclature to deprive private owners of land of their right to use their land, to put expansion of refuges on rails, and to do other things that just seem to set the process in effect too much towards expanding refuges. So, also, you know, if there's land that's going to be added to a refuge, that's the legislature's authority to make those decisions. It should not be automatically. I'd be concerned that private people may find land on the border of a refuge, buy it, and present it to the state, which, you know, may or may not take it up, I guess. But in doing so, it would automatically take on the color of a refuge, which is an authority and a color that belongs to this body to issue, not by automatic execution of executive ownership. So, yeah, I've got to support this amendment because I think the bill does too much.
Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
I'll try not to intervene any more than I need to. All of the comments are policy calls, except for two that I want to make sure, because I want to dispel folks of them. I don't think the bill does anything to remove the right or deprive the right of a private landowner to use their land. If anything, there's an element Mr. Meehan could explain where there's some growth of the right of a private landowner to use their land. So that's number one. Number two, Representative Sadler, with great respect, said the bill came to us as a borders reform bill. That's inaccurate. The bill was CS'd, but in modest ways, and the bill has always had these other elements. Thank you.
thank you, Representative Josephson. Representative Elam, do you have any wrap-up?
Thank you. I appreciate the dialogue and would appreciate the support on the bill. I do just want to say that I wanted to find a solution that I felt could, you know, still respect the work that the team has put in for the map corrections and everything without necessarily getting into the additional layers of what really felt like some additional bills maybe that needed to be done. And so, I do respectfully ask for everybody's support on the amendment. And so that is all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Elam. I'm going to maintain my objection. So with that, will the clerk please call the roll?
Here we go. Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Cologne.
Yes.
Representative Elam.
Yes.
Representative Hall.
No.
Representative Mears.
No.
Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Co-Chair Dibert.
No.
Co-Chair Freer.
No.
Four yeas, five nays.
And with a vote of four yeas and five nays, amendment number 23 is not adopted. We will go back up the roll to amendment number one, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I must say I'm impressed by the cell phone connectivity Representative Elam is getting on his drive south. That's impressive. Madam Chair, I offer amendment number one.
And I object for the purposes of discussion. Would you like to speak to your amendment?
Yes, ma'am. So Amendment 1, it does kind of a positive negative thing. It removes the ban on personal watercraft use. I'm sorry, it would, let me just cut to the chase. It would leave the situation in Kachemak Bay status quo, which means that the commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game has the authority to make that decision and respects the decision that has been made that personal watercraft use in this areas is allowed. So, I think earlier when we discussed the bill, that there's gone a long adjudicatory process and public comment and so forth has been engaged in on personal watercraft use in Kachemak Bay and Fox River Flats. The decision by the executive branch, judicial branch, says that it is allowed, and I had concerns about the legislative branch coming in and changing that. So adoption of this amendment would leave things as they are.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Josephson?
Just in two sentences, Madam Chair, the testimony you heard was, I think, entirely in support of the bill as written, with the deletion of the personal watercraft. There's no doubt that it's not a universally held position. It's a policy call. It's a change. The real change was the administration's change, right? So historically, these were not allowed. Now they are, and we would like it restored to its previous situation.
Is there further discussion? Representative Colom?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So I support this. This has been a longstanding issue. It's gone through the courts. I know it's a big battle, but I don't see how it relates to the purpose of the bill in any way, shape, or form.
Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I agree that it's, if you will, I don't have a dog in the fight. It's down somewhere south of Anchorage, I think, somewhere in Alaska. But in the interior, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. But I, too, remember hearing a lot of discussion about this in the interior. Mm-hmm. And that was a hard-fought battle. I don't think we should open up that can of worms, so I support this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Prox.
Madam Chair.
Representative Elam.
Thank you. I support the amendment as well. Kachemak Bay is not really very far from my home. It's one of my neighboring districts, actually. And I do know that it is kind of a contentious issue with a few families, and it kind of turns into sort of a Hatfields and McCoys issue. But I do know that a very large number of community members here on the Kenai Peninsula do want to maintain the current status of personal watercraft in our waterways down there. And so I will be voting in support of this current amendment.
Chair, can I add something?
Representative Clone?
Yeah, so my husband and I are in Kachemak Bay all summer. We go through there all the time. Ever since the change, I think I've seen one jet ski. It's not a major issue.
Thank you, Representative Clone. Representative Josephson?
We oppose Amendment 1.
Okay. With that, I will maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Sadler?
Yes.
Representative Prox?
Yes.
Representative Colom?
Yes.
Representative Elam?
Yes.
Representative Hall?
No.
Representative Mears?
No.
Representative Fields?
No.
Co-Chair Dibert?
No.
Co-Chair Freer?
No.
4 yeas, 5 nays.
Thank you. With a vote of 4 yeas and 5 nays, Amendment 1 is not adopted. Representative Sather, I believe you also have Amendment 2.
I do indeed. Well, I move Amendment number 2.
I object for the purposes of discussion.
Well, Madam Chair, that's pretty straightforward. This, if adopted, Amendment 2 would remove the, would leave the decision of whether to ban or limit watercraft in the Kachemak Bay, specifically just the Kachemak Bay Wildlife Refuge with the commissioner, exclusive of issues on the Fox River Flats Wildlife Refuge. So this trims it back to have a slightly smaller scope and would ask members to support this one.
Thank you, Representative Sather. Representative Josephson?
We object to the amendment. And I would emphasize that in that location, for example, Joe would know, Mr. Meehan would know a lot more about this, but this is an area of tourism, so it's economic for sure, but it is an area where you don't see boats moving at high speed. You see birders, you see kayakers, you see tourists often taking ferries to McDonald's Spit or around the bend to Seldovia. It's an area of calm. It's an area of scientific study for estuary and marine environments, and we just don't think it's conducive with that. So we object. We oppose that amendment.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Is there further discussion? Representative Sadler?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, we've again, this issue has been adjudicated. People have had their say. It's gone through the process. The courts have said this is the bailiwick of the commissioner. This is a wildlife refuge. Wildlife, animals, fish and game. The commissioner of fish and game has an obligation to consider all these uses, all these interests, and has made a decision. This bill would upend that and reverse that decision. To the point, this being calm, I had the privilege of spending a couple days in Homer over Easter weekend. I looked out and saw skiffs, I saw freighters, I saw fishing boats, a lot of fishing boats. I think it was the White King ferry. There's provisions for ferries. This is an important motorized waterway. This is not just a kayak and canoe area. Mm-hmm. So the idea that we should, by legislation, reverse it and have one element of motorized transportation deprived of the people of Alaska is, I disagree with it. And that's why I offered the amendment. That's why I stand by it.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Seeing no further discussion, I'm going to maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll? I need you to speak
about Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Colomb.
Yes.
Representative Elam.
Yes.
Representative Hall.
No.
Representative Mears.
No.
Co-chair Dibert.
No.
Co-chair Freer.
No.
Four yeas, five nays.
With a vote of four yeas and five nays, Amendment 2 is not adopted. Representative Sather, you also have Amendment 3.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, I move Amendment number 3.
I object for purposes of discussion.
Yeah. Well, you know, in looking at the vote on the previous two amendments, it would both have very similar effects. I noticed that members from the actual areas affected, specifically the Kenai Peninsula, thought these were good amendments. And I anticipate he'll support this one again, but To the merits of the amendment, again, this is a decision that has been adjudicated, and the commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game, who has responsibility for wildlife refuges, has determined that it's the appropriate thing to do is to allow personal watercraft in these areas. Again, we have other kinds of motorized transport in Kachemak Bay, and Fox River Flats is up at the head of Kachemak Bay. So I'm not sure. Well, I won't say that. So I think the people that have an interest and have heard from my constituents, who are primarily not residents of Kachemak Bay, but who do recreate there, they would like to see the opportunity to use these public lands and public waters for their recreation and enjoyment, and this amendment would restore that to them. The underlying bill would deny that to them inappropriately, I think, so that's why I offer the amendment and encourage members to consider their vote and vote yes.
Thank you, Representative Sander. Representative Josephson?
Yes, as sponsor, I oppose the amendment. I invite Mr. Meehan, who knows that part of Kachemak Bay better, to make a couple sentences of testimony.
Mr. Meehan?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Joe Meehan again for the record. Fox River Flats is probably a particularly sensitive area in Kachemak Bay. It's at the head of the bay, very shallow water, mud flats, estuarine lagoons. And soon here, with the bird migration, there'll be probably tens of thousands of waterfowl and shorebirds coming in and using that area. That's a particularly sensitive area for watercraft that have very shallow draft, such as personal watercraft, and can move at high speeds and quick turns. So that's one of the particular concerns with those type of vessels operating in the Fox River Flats area. And just a point of history here, when this regulation prohibiting personal watercraft was first in place, there have since been multiple requests to rescind that regulation. And I just want to point out that five fish and game commissioners and five governors have denied that request over the intervening 20 years or so.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. Representative Colomb?
I have two questions, and I apologize. I don't have a copy of the amendment. I just wanted to ask the maker of the amendment. Does your amendment remove Section 74, lines 6 through 14?
If you want to brief it easy while I filter through.
I can answer that question. Yeah. And,
please,
and
please.
Yes, it would. It, okay. It would remove Section 74 and 77.
Okay. Thank you. I have everything else. That one, I don't know. It's not here.
Did you still want to verify, Representative Souther, take
well,
a brief of these?
I saw a copy. Okay. I saw a copy. Thank you. Sorry for that.
That's good. That's a lot of pages, a lot of stuff. So.
The only reason why I asked that is because this isn't just personal watercraft. This is pretty prescriptive. A person may not operate personal watercraft in the Fox River Flats. And then they have a definition of a personal watercraft, less than 16 feet, propelled by a water jet pump or machinery as its primary source of motor propulsion, designed to be operated by a person sitting, standing, kneeling on a vessel rather than a person sitting, standing inside the vessel. So it's pretty prescriptive. It's a brand new section. It's not just a jet ski. It has other implications, the restrictions. I guess I would ask... Mr. Meehan, in the regulations that are here around Fox River now, is that what the regulation is, or does this section go further in describing exactly what watercraft is, if you know?
Through the chair, Representative Colomb, of course, there is no regulation currently prohibiting personal watercraft in Kachemak Bay or Fox River Flats.
Okay.
That definition that we put in HB 321 was taken from the old regulation.
Oh, the old regulation.
Yes.
Okay. I just was trying to find out where the wordage is. So it hasn't been restrictive for a long time, I guess. Is there a reason why we need to restrict it in an environmental way? You just think it's going to be too disruptive to the wildlife?
Mr. Meehan.
Through the chair, Representative Colomb, the original reason for the adoption of the regulation prohibiting them was, I guess, threefold. One was environmental contaminants.
Mm-hmm.
The second was user conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
And the third was wildlife disturbance. Now, admittedly, the personal watercraft industry has come a long way since the late 1990s and early 2000s when this regulation was first put in place. And they've gone from two-stroke engines to four strokes.
Right.
Noise has been reduced. So some of the environmental impacts have been reduced greatly in that regard. But again, it remains the user conflicts and the disturbance to wildlife, mainly because of the way these vessels are designed to be used and the way they are used in practicality, which is high speeds, quick maneuvers, shallow waters.
And at this time, right now, it's a game refuge or critical habitat right now.
Critical habitat area for Fox River Flats.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So just with that, I mean, obviously, we use that area all the time, so I'm not a fan of restricting watercraft. I find people very responsible there, and Kachemak Bay, too. We know the importance of maintaining the environment, and so I support the amendment. I don't think we need to be restricting access.
Thank you, Representative Colomb. Representative Souther?
I do have a question, Madam Chair, for Mr. Meehan. Inside the Fox River Flats Wildlife Refuge, are there any motorized boats or any motorized uses currently allowed?
Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, there is an authorized off-road vehicle trail that goes through the Fox River Flats critical habitat area. I do know vessels going over to the Bradley Lake hydroelectric facility where there's a dock do take vessels into there. For the rest of the critical habitat area, I'm not aware of vessels going in there, but I haven't been down there at all times of the year. Again, it's a pretty shallow area, so if vessels do go in there, they'd have to exercise due caution not to go aground.
I don't wish to debate the issue, but I would just say if there are currently watercraft of whatever kind available, looks like we're discriminating against one particular kind, but that's a debate and clearly where we stand, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Prox?
Well, thank you. Through the chair, I guess I am interested in that. I'm not quite sure what your what you're trying to accomplish or what was trying to be accomplished in the first place. But it sounds like you are just focusing on personal watercraft, and that would mean that a 20-foot boat with an outboard motor or an inboard motor or what else, whatever would be allowed, or airboats would be allowed, and I'm not understanding the significance of restricting. Well, I guess you could run oil tankers in there. I'm not sure why you're restricting the personal watercraft. What is trying to be accomplished with this? I'm just not familiar with the area at all.
Mr. Meehan.
Through the chair, Representative Prox. Again, it beckons back to the way these type of vessels are designed to be used and are used in the field. Fast speeds, quick maneuvers, oftentimes running in groups, access to shallow water.
That's where the legislature...
Thank you, Representative Prox. Mr. Meehan, with that, not seeing further discussion, I maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Mears.
No.
Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Cologne.
Yes.
Representative Elam.
Yes.
Representative Hall.
No.
Co-chair Dibert.
No.
Co-chair Freer.
No.
4 yeas, 5 nays.
A vote of 4 yeas and 5 nays. Amendment number 3 is not adopted. Next, I have amendment number 4 by Representative Clum. Representative Clum.
Since this amendment's already been offered, I'll withdraw that.
Okay. And amendment number 5 by Representative Cologne.
I move amendment number 5.
Object for the purposes of discussion.
So amendment 5 removes section 7 of the bill. It's on page 4, lines 13 through 23. So this, you know, the section 7's one, the thing that I've been asking a lot of questions about. It restricts the discharge of firearms when it includes target shooting. So in a way, you can say, well, it protects discharging firearms. But in this, it only protects it in the first line. Discharge of firearms during lawful activities, including hunting, trapping, and fishing. But then there's an important except in line 16. Except that the department may, for purposes of public safety, close a designated area within a wildlife refuge to discharge a firearm for purposes other than hunting, trapping, and fishing. And this is an issue for Rabbit Creek Shooting Park that's in the refuge. This is giving authority to the department to restrict the discharge of weapons. And it also uses words, the department may by regulation prohibit public access to a refuge if it protects public health and safety and allows for safe operation. So this was around an issue around Rabbit Creek Shooting Range and people walking downrange of it. This bill has gone way farther. This is not an ancillary topic. This is the use of firearms within a refuge. If I remember right, the sponsor was trying to narrow this definition, but because there was a legal issue and I got a legal memo on one of my amendments, you can't do it narrow. You can't just protect a shooting range. And so what this does actually says the department can restrict the use of discharge of firearms in the entire refuge. They can't just pick and choose. Because they think there's a public safety threat, that they can restrict that. And I don't want the department having that kind of power. Second of all, I think that has an unintended consequences to the Rabbit Creek shooting range or shooting park, which is really a hub of hunter ed training. Kids, we have kids, teams of kids shooting clays. People go there of all ages to learn how to shoot all kinds of firearms, archery. They have classrooms there. That has a major impact to that park, and I don't think this paragraph really should be in the bill at all. I think we need to that's for another time. I know the intent of this was to stop target shooting at trailheads, but it's gotten much broader since then. They can't do that. I can't just protect Rabbit Creek. So now you have an authority within the entire refuge of not allowing shooting for target purposes. And so I think this is a little, the language is a little clunky. If you want to try to restrict target shooting at the trailheads, I think we should explore a different way to do that.
Thank you, Representative Clome. Representative Josephson?
Well, we object to the amendment. I think there are a couple things that I think, with great respect, Representative Clome may have incorrect. She talked about clay shooting and the other elements at the Rabbit Creek Range. Those items are enhanced by this bill. They are enhanced because we're saying downrange shooting due south toward the water. The department could issue restrictions so that no one gets hurt. And the primary person driving that is, let me rephrase, the person who would have the exclusive use at certain times would be the practice marksman or firearm user. They would be in first place. So, I know, that the commissioner liked that provision of this bill. He saw a potential problem identified by Mr. Meehan in the bill. I think, and Mr. Meehan can illuminate you further, but in terms of closures to certain areas for target practice, so this would not be the fire range target practice. This is a makeshift fire target shooting area within the refuge. The State Parks Division does something similar, and Mr. Meehan can give you the site for that. But fundamentally, this amendment, or as not the amendment, as written, the bill is about safety for various user groups. It's about the cost of cleaning up contamination, where you have a makeshift site that becomes sort of embedded within the refuge. And frankly, folks, instead of using the fire range, they say, forget the fire range. We're going to just set up our own shop, and we'll fire away. And that causes the need for cleanup. So, and then in terms of what Representative Colomb said about a legal challenge, originally, in an abundance of precaution, Mr. Bullard, who I guess is online, talked about how there could be, if you restrict just certain parts of the area, you could have some issues about what are called special and local acts. So we have a constitutional framework that says you have to sort of broadly apply things. But I think that I know that in the CS, we've dealt with that, we think, responsibly, and there wouldn't be a closure for everything. There would be narrow places Department of Fish and Game could close in the interest of public safety and habitat protection. Mr. Meehan, do you want to add anything to what I said?
Sure. Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Colomb, just to highlight a couple things in the bill in Section A for this section that we're talking about firearms, it says the discharge of firearms during lawful activities, including hunting, trapping, fishing. That's not an exclusive list. The including could include any potential reason to legally discharge your firearm. And so, again, like Representative Josephson said, it just has to do with non-hunting, non-fishing, non-trapping purposes at access sites and trailheads, i.e. target shooting. The other thing to point out, too, is, again, the department is going to adopt regulations through the public process and receive public comment on any proposals to close or restrict target shooting in any areas or to close any areas to access, i.e. the Rabbit Creek shooting range, for public safety reasons. And as far as the closure, access closure provision, the bill does say to close it potentially in designated areas And it goes on to say, if it's reasonably necessary to, one, protect the public's health and safety, or two, allow for the safe operation of a facility within the refuge. So I think that gives the department and the public sideboards on exactly what could be done there to either restrict discharge of firearms for target shooting or for public access downrange of an active range. And as we heard the commissioner testify, he liked the idea of a light or a flag indicating when the firing range is actually open and active so that people didn't go downrange. And I will point out, too, that in Chapter 41, Title 41 in statute, it gives Alaska State Parks very similar authority to close state park areas to the discharge of firearms for public safety.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, looking at the bill, it says, bill before the amendment says the department can restrict shooting throughout the entire refuge. I understand there's a specific geographical coverage issues, but for any purpose, not just for hunting, fishing, or trapping, but for any reason, it gives the department discretion through regulatory decision to decide what public safety concerns might justify a ban on shooting. And again, this is not just the Rabbit Creek shooting range. Language would apply to any wildlife refuge, so there's no delineation or differentiation. And as I recall, the commissioner said that a flag might work, and a flag at a range, you know, basically saying this is a hot range, would be a minimum necessary action to eliminate danger. But a blanket ban, or the authority to do a blanket ban, certainly gives you more safety. But, gosh, if you just banned all firearms, we could just enhance public safety immensely. I think we have an obligation in light of our constitutional right to keep and bear arms to limit any prescription on that authority to the minimum necessary to achieve a specific public purpose, not just a conditional or maybe a potential public purpose. This is overreach. This is not good. We should amend it out of here.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Prox, did I see your hand up?
No, you didn't.
I did not.
Might have been up, but you didn't see it.
Okay. Is there a further discussion?
Can I do a wrap?
I'm sorry?
Can I do a wrap?
Oh, sorry. Yes, Representative Colomb, wrap up.
Yeah, so just to address a couple things. So this issue with downrange and people getting hurt, first of all, no one's gotten shot in 50 years, but not to say that, you know, it's still a safety concern. My understanding, there's signs up there, okay. But this is a contested area in Anchorage. If you don't live in Anchorage or South Anchorage, you don't know the fights going on with the range and being able to hunt there. If they do this under public safety, you are also limiting hunting down there too because of public safety. And again, most duck hunters go hunting at sunrise. The range is not open. This is not an issue. This is not only overreach, but just overdoing what the perceived problem is. Also, if there's so many, in my opinion, there's so many in between the lines meanings going on here. This is definitely a threat to Rabbit Creek Shooting Range. Whether it stays open, whether activities are there, whether you can hunt on the coast, all of this is basically saying the department can not only close down the range, which I don't anticipate them doing, but they could do it. I mean, the commissioner may not be there, may have a commissioner who doesn't like that. There's a lot of people that don't like the range there, and then there's a lot of people that don't want people hunting there. And so this is just the restrictions on discharge of firearms and public access, that is the title of the section. The restrictions on the discharge of firearms and public access. I cannot support this bill ever if this any part of this paragraph is in it. It's really, really important to take this out. This is not cleaning up boundaries. This is someone saying we need to restrict. This has been a thing for a while around Rabbit Creek Rifle Range that we want to restrict the hunting around, we want to restrict the range. And so that's why I put forward the amendment. I think it's a stronger bill without the paragraph.
Thank you, Representative Clum. That was wrap-up comments, but Representative...
Okay, I'm sorry. No, go ahead. That's fine.
Would you like to make your comments, Representative Prox?
No, I was going to start a question.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
With that, I maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll?
To clarify, which amendment was
this? This is amendment number 5, H.6.
Thank you. Representative Elam.
No. I'm sorry, yes.
Representative Hall.
No.
Representative Mears.
No.
Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Klum.
Yes.
Co-chair Dibert.
No.
Co-chair Freer.
No.
4 yeas, 5 nays.
And with a vote of 4 yeas and 5 nays, amendment number 5, H.6, is not adopted.
Madam Chair?
Representative Elam?
Yes, I just wanted to make sure that my vote was recorded as a yes.
Yes, your vote was recorded as a yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Elam. Next, we have amendment number 6, H.7, by Representative Klum.
Yeah, I move number amendment 6.
I object for the purposes of discussion.
So amendment 6 is the same paragraph, but I leave the first sentence, the discharge of firearms during lawful activities, including hunting, trapping, and fishing, is permitted with the boundaries of the wildlife refuge, and then I delete the rest.
Same
arguments.
Representative Josephson?
We oppose the amendment.
Representative Sadler?
At a certain point, I just want to say my comments are ditto, comments based on Amendment 5, so I'll save some time and just say ditto.
Is there further discussion? Do you have any other wrap-up, Representative Klum?
No, I just retain the, lawful activities, including hunting, trapping, and fishing, are permitted. Keep that there, but take away the restriction on firearms and hunting, or I mean firearms and the discharge of firearms within the Rabbit Creek range and other ranges. It's important to know for anybody listening that this is a direct hit to your freedom to discharge a firearm and to target shoot in any refuge. The department can take that away at any time. It's not a state park. State parks are very different than refuges. So that's all I have to say, I guess.
Thank you, Representative Klum. I maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll on amendment number 6?
Representative Klum.
Yes.
Representative Elam.
Yes.
Representative Hall.
No.
Representative Mears.
No.
Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Co-chair Dibert.
No.
Co-chair Freer.
No.
4 yeas, 5 nays.
With a vote of 4 yeas and 5 nays, amendment number 6 is not adopted. Next, I've got amendment number 7, H.24, by Representative Klum.
I move amendment number 7.
I object for the purposes of discussion. Representative Klum.
So amendment 7, same paragraph. This time I'm just taking out 16 through 18, which is regarding the discharge of firearms. I'm leaving in the first sentence, which is the discharge of firearms during lawful activities, including hunting, trapping, and fishing. And I also leave in B, that the department may regulate public access within a refuge. All I'm doing is taking out the firearms part between 16 and 18 and leaving the rest of the section.
Thank you, Representative Klum. Representative Josephson?
I oppose this respectfully. As I understand it, the target shooting issue, makeshift target shooting, would continue, resulting in public safety issues and potential further contamination with lead, for example. Mr. Meehan testified that the department spent millions of dollars to clean up these sorts of sites, and so we oppose.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Is there discussion? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, some of the observations and criticisms of the bill to date have been that it's too broad and far-reaching, but we were assured that this was not too broad and far-reaching, but the amendments that we're offering, including this one, to try and scope it down, have received resistance. So it tends to increase my belief that this bill is indeed too far-reaching. So on that basis, I will support this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Is there further discussion?
We have a wrap-up. Did you have something, Mike? Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to point out, so we keep hearing about the lead contamination, and I know that there's issues with people abandoning their cars and people shooting at them, whatever. But sometimes a dad will take his son out or his daughter out and take a couple of shots at a can. That is not the big problem that they're trying to solve, but that could be effective. I think a lot of Alaskans do that. We're not going out. I mean, if you go out, if you want to rope in every time an adult goes with a kid to shoot cans and do target practice once in a while, I think it's pretty unfair that would be banned because in certain areas people take advantage of it and, you know, ruin the area. That's not going to solve that, and I don't think Alaskans would want that. So please support the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Colomb. That's how I first learned.
Me too. And my kids.
And but I do maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Colomb.
Yes.
Representative Elam.
Yes.
Representative Hall.
No.
Representative Mears.
No.
Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Co-chair Dibert.
No.
Co-chair Freer.
No.
4 yeas, 5 nays.
Thank you. With the vote of 4 yeas and 5 nays, amendment number 7 is not adopted. Next, I've got amendment number 8, H.25, by Representative Colomb.
Yeah, I'm going to withdraw number 8.
Okay. Next, I've got amendment number 9, H.9, by Representative Colomb.
Just give me a second here.
Okay.
Okay, this is page 38, line 17.
Do you move your...
Oh, sorry. I move amendment number 9.
Thank you, Representative Colomb. I will object for the purposes of discussion.
That's the wrong page here. So, the amendment brings this language back to the original statute. The bill is proposing that the legislature make this decision, not the Board of Game. So this is in relation to McNeil. It has been closed by the Board of Game for a long time. And actually, whether you agree that you should hunt there or not, really this is a policy decision. We are removing the power from the Board of Game to close hunting and putting it in statute and having the legislature do it. And for me, I would rather have the Board of Game make those decisions and not the legislature. It's not a statement on whether this area should have hunting or not. It's putting it in statute and having the legislature ban hunting. It has been done, but very rare. And I think this should the power should stay with the Board of Game.
Thank you, Representative Colomb. Representative Josephson?
Yes, we object to the amendment. I respect the power of the Board of Game, certainly. The argument made in the bill, or in committee at least, was that the Board of Game, I think, partly out of concern with blowback, but also, in fairness, with respect and concern for the wildlife viewing opportunity within the sanctuary, has for decades banned the area to the north of the sanctuary, and then also to the southwest of the sanctuary and to the east of the sanctuary in what's called the Kamishak Bay area. And this would essentially make those closures permanent. But as I said, given the opportunity multiple times to make them impermanent, the Board of Game has said, no, we're not going to do that. And so this is fairly consistent with where the Board of Game traditionally has stood. It's actually completely consistent. I want to be clear about that.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Mr. Meehan, did you want to add any?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just might point out that the legislature has taken action in the past to close areas to discharge firearms for hunting. And admittedly, these are three very unique situations. One is hunting with firearms is prohibited within 5 miles of the haul road between the Yukon River and the Arctic Ocean, obviously to protect the pipeline. The second one was to prohibit the taking of brown or grizzly bears within a half a mile of a solid waste facility, obviously so people aren't taking dump garbage habituated bears. And then thirdly, the legislature closed the McNeil River Sanctuary to all hunting and trapping because of its unique status. And so this is just recognizing that same unique status from the sanctuary and the history of the area with the Board of Game keeping it closed for decades.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. Representative Fields, then Representative Sadler.
Yeah, I was just going to note this is a unique area in terms of the amount of economic activity of bear viewing, and while I normally support Board of Game authority in this area, in this case, I think it's appropriate to for that predictability for the industry where there's a lot of visitation.
Thank you, Representative Fields. I've got Representative Sadler, Prox, and Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I'm seeing a concerning theme running through the response to these proposed amendments to the bill. You know, I'll observe that we have a commissioner of Fish and Game with responsibilities and powers to accomplish the mission. They have expert staff on board. They have scientific budgets. We have the Board of Game with responsibilities and powers to manage game. They have their advisory committees. They have their own scientists. But now we are substituting for these informed specific responsibilities of Fish and Game and the commissioner of Fish and Game, Board of Game and commissioner, the legislature. We are generalists who are much more susceptible to interest groups, and we are making decisions. We're proposed to make policy decisions on some pretty highly emotional issues, the personal watercraft issue, bear hunting in this area. I just don't feel comfortable with us interposing ourselves and depriving the experts, in this case the Board of Game's ability to manage and to fulfill their continuing responsibility. It does not matter whether this would, you believe, comport with that decision or be consistent with it. The decision does not lie with us to be consistent. The decision should be made of the people that have that responsibility. So I'm going to vote yes.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Prox. And just want to note the time. It's 2:57. There's another committee that'll be here in 15 minutes or so. So we'll get through. You two have some wrap up, and then try to get through the last amendment before we take a recess until this evening. Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would agree with Representative Sadler. Okay, the board has done it 3 times previously. The legislature has done it 3 times previously. I disagreed with those decisions back then as a member of the public. So I think this should remain within the Board of Game, and therefore I support the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Prox. Representative Hall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I've had the good fortune of visiting McNeil River twice in my capacity as a videographer, and it's a quite unique and special place, and all the people who have the opportunity to be there know and feel. It's an overwhelming sense of feeling to be in that at McNeil, and so for that, and similar to the reasons that Representative Fields mentioned, I am a no vote.
Representative Sadler.
And Madam Chair, and that's exactly the point of my comments. We should not manage game and delegate authority based on feelings. I have also been to the McNeil River. It's a great place, but the Board of Game has responsibility for that wonderful place. My feelings notwithstanding. So.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Coulomb, do you have a wrap-up?
Yeah, just to clarify, this doesn't have any thing to do with the actual McNeil Refuge. It's the areas around it. But I would say that if there's consistency and the Board of Game have been consistent, I'm not sure the legislature would actually provide that kind of consistency because politics go left and right all the time. And I think it's more vulnerable to be open for hunting if it was left with the legislature. I don't know of anybody who's a biologist except for one in the legislature. I don't have the expertise to know when to close it, open it. And I'm just telling you, it has nothing to do with wanting it to have hunting on it or not. It's a policy call. Do you think the legislature's best to close this, or do you keep it with the Board of Game? And I would suggest that we keep it with the Board of Game. They've been doing a good job.
Thank you, Representative Coulomb. With that, I'm going to maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll? Oh, and this is on amendment number 9, H.9.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Coulomb.
Yes.
Representative Elam.
Yes.
Representative Hall.
No.
Representative Mears.
No.
Representative Fields.
No.
Co-chair Dibert.
No.
Co-chair Freer.
No.
4 yeas, 5 nays.
And with a vote of 4 yeas and 5 nays, amendment number 9 is not adopted. At this time, it is 3 p.m., and we will go at, we'll take a recess for Labor and Commerce Committee and come back for
5:15.
Let's say 5:30. Or actually, we'll say 5:15 just in case. No, just kidding. 5:30. Yeah.
Yeah. There's 6 bills.
Yeah. Delayed to the call of the chair.
Make it 7. Be smart.
Yeah. So we'll see you all back here shortly after 5 o'clock.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Battery.
This meeting of the House Resources Committee will come back to order. The time now is 5:33 p.m., Friday, April 17, 2026, in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Fields, Representative Coulomb, Representative Hall, Representative Mears, Representative Prox, Representative Elam is on Teams, and Representative Sadler, as well as Co-Chair Representative Dibert, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Freer. Let the record reflect that we once again have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. I'd like to thank Andrew Magnuson from Records and Renzo Moises from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. We left off earlier this afternoon on amendment number 10 by Representative Coulomb. We've got Representative Josephson as well as his staff Joe Meehan here with us. We'll just get straight back into amendments and start off with amendment number 10, H.10, by Representative Coulomb.
I move amendment 10.
And I object for the purposes of discussion.
So amendment 10 addresses an issue from before. It's a section prohibiting the hunting of brown bear in Kamishak Bay. I just, again, feel like the Board of Game should have that decision, not the legislature, so this removes this. And just to be clear, this doesn't have anything to do with the McNeil area. This is the area south of McNeil that has been closed for bear hunting for a long time from the decision of the Board of Game. And again, just I don't think the legislature is the best one to make those decisions. We have the Board of Game to do that, and so the amendment is to remove that section.
Thank you, Representative Coulomb. Representative Josephson.
Yes, we oppose Amendment 10. The maker of the amendment said that this doesn't concern McNeil, but it does concern McNeil. It's essentially the same vote you've cast on Amendment 9. It has basically the same effect. Amendment 9 reverted the decision of Board of Game. Amendment 10 would effectively revert the decision of the Board of Game as well, as I understand it. I can't tell what the difference is.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Did I see your hand, Representative Sadler?
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, I wish to associate myself with the remarks of Representative Cologne. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Prox?
Yes, the same. I would like to agree we should pass this amendment. The Board of Game is the appropriate group. There is some possibility, for instance, that the population, bear population, could increase to the point, if you will, that they're eating themselves out of house and home, and then that results in a collapse. We don't know the future, but the Board of Game is supposed to pay attention to that. We should let that up to the Board of Game.
Thank you, Representative Prox. Do you have any wrap-up comments, Representative Clone?
Nope.
Okay, with that, I maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll on Amendment Number 10, H.10?
Representative Hall?
No.
Representative Mears?
No.
Representative Fields?
No.
Representative Sadler?
Yes.
Representative Prox?
Yes.
Representative Colomb?
Yes.
Representative Elam?
Yes.
Co-Chair Dibert?
No.
Co-Chair Freer?
No.
Five nays. Four nays. Yays.
Mr. Magnuson, can you please state the count or the vote again?
Five nays, four yays.
With a vote of four yays and five nays, Amendment Number 10 is not adopted. Next, we have Amendment Number 11, H.29, by Representative Colomb.
I move Amendment 11.
And I object for the purposes of discussion, Representative Colomb. Sorry.
So this amendment is on page 39, line 21. It removes the words private ownership or. So this section 50 is a brand new section statute. It's not amending current statute. But it's saying before the use, lease, or disposal of land under private ownership or state jurisdiction within the refuge, they have to notify the commissioner, and the commissioner can shall acknowledge the receipt notice of return mail. So if there is private ownership within a refuge and you want to sell it, you want to improve it, you want to develop it, you're being required to go through the commissioner to get that approval. It does retain the state jurisdiction and control. So if the state wants to do it, a state department or agency wants to do something on a piece of land, they have to notify the commissioner, but the amendment just removes private ownership and on line 23, the person.
Representative Josephson?
Madam Chair, I object to the amendment. I'd ask Mr. Meehan to describe his or our concerns with it.
Mr. Meehan?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is not a new statute. This is simply being renumbered and moved due to the combining of critical habitat areas and refuges. And I also will point out that this, in all likelihood, is a moot issue because we are proposing to redefine all critical habitat areas to encompass only state-owned lands. So by default, that would exclude private lands.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. Representative Sadler, did you have your hand up?
Thank you. Yes, I did. Thank you, Mr. You know, The terminology, Mr. Meehan, you certainly know better than I do, but it seems that the bill does collapse the critical habitat and game refuse terminologies, and I'm not exactly sure in which all cases what that means. I'm going to use the term inholders to describe the private landholders inside of a refuge, sanctuary. I'm not sure the term. So, but my concern is with private property rights. If the person who owns private property has to go to the commissioner for a mother may I, then that's just one more example of how the bill does so much more than just, true up some map boundaries. And so I support this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Madam Chair.
Representative Elam.
Thank you. If I understand this amendment correctly, this is specifically with private landholders around wildlife refuges. Does that include federal wildlife refuges? I'm just curious because here on the Kenai Peninsula, we have a significant amount of private land that is held through native corporations. Siri actually owns a lot of land around our wildlife refuges, and I'm just wondering how that relationship dynamic works there between the private holders that are corporations versus what we traditionally think of as private holders, like myself as a owner of a small lot of land. So I'm just curious what the dynamic difference would be and if it would apply in those situations too.
Thank you, Representative Elam. Mr. Meehan.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, this would have no effect whatsoever on the federal Kenai National Wildlife Refuge lands. Since there are no state lands being managed within that refuge, this would have no bearing on that whatsoever.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan.
Follow-up, please?
Follow-up?
Yes, please. The situation is that there's usually state lands that are state-owned, but then not necessarily with any kind of a designation. Sometimes they have designations, but they usually butt up next to federal wildlife refuge, and then they're partnered in it, and they're kind of co-mingled between native corporation lands and state lands. And then we also have, we don't have state forest, but there's just a very wide spread of land, and so it's kind of a mixed checkerboard. But yet the large private sections of land are continuous, usually in nature. So if a chunk of wildlife refuge that is state refuge based down in, say, Homer, is butted up next to native corporation land, and then that would it apply in that situation to that large continuous tract that may run for miles?
Mr. Meehan?
Madam Co-Chair, I'll try to answer the question. Again, this statute is simply moving it, renumbering it from its current numbering system. And again, it's only applicable to state wildlife refuges created under Alaska Statute 1625-50 through 690. As far as I know, there are very little or no native corporation lands in the refuges on the southern Kenai, such as the Anchor River, Fritz Creek Critical Habitat Area. So without seeing a map or looking further, I'm not sure I totally understand the question.
Does that answer your question?
I don't know that it...
Follow-up, Representative Elam.
Thank you. I guess it's just something that I was pondering, and I'll have to review it maybe a little bit more offline. But I think... And it's just because of the checkerboarding of the land allocations of how things are done. So I'll follow up offline, or maybe check with one of our department heads to see if they have any kind of input on that. Thank you for your insight.
Thank you, Representative Elam. Representative Josephson?
Yes. As I understand it, Madam Chair, the provision that Mr. Meehan was talking about is actually, as drafted in the bill, not in current law, is actually of benefit to private landowners. Because now the focus is exclusively on state-owned lands. It would not include any private ownership within a greater system, if you will. And so the mother may I concern that Representative Sadler has is actually, I think, satisfied and improved by this, by the bill as drafted. Because that was a provision in critical habitat areas that's not moved into the refuge language.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Representative Colomb, do you have any?
Yeah, so it's my understanding that private ownership does include Native corporation lands, correct? Yeah.
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah. So in those refuges that you're trying to switch from fish and game to Native corporations, that releases them of getting permits. But this does not release them from getting permission from the commissioner to develop their land or have a change on their lands?
Madam Chair, Representative Colomb, I think to get into the level of detail that perhaps Leg Legal is the best one to ask that of. Again, the jurisdictions for the refuges that we're proposing in the bill only include state-owned lands. I think it's a pretty fair assumption to say that this would mostly not be applicable. But again, I don't want to speak for Leg Legal. That might be a question for attorneys.
Yeah, I guess, well, if we're going to pass a bill, we should understand what it's saying. But it says before the use, lease, or other disposal of land under private ownership shall notify the commissioner. So I'm just saying, you know, whether it's Native corporation land within a refuge or state-owned land within a refuge, there is, you're not removing that contingency. They still have to go through the commissioner. I don't have anything else to say.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Colomb. I am going to maintain my objection. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Elam.
Passed.
Representative Hall.
No.
Representative Mears.
No.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Prox?
Yes.
Representative Fields?
No.
Representative Colomb?
Yes.
Representative Elam?
Yes.
Co-Chair Dibert?
No.
Co-Chair Freer?
No.
4 yeas, 5 nays.
With a vote of 4 yeas and 5 nays, Amendment Number 11 is not adopted. Next up in amendments, I have Amendment Number 12, H.15, by Representative Colomb.
I move Amendment 12.
I object for the purposes of discussion.
So Amendment 12 is on page 20, line 29, and I spoke with the sponsor about this, so my amendment, right now the bill is taking out and excluding privately owned land, and my amendment is putting that back in. I understand at the beginning of the sentence it says state-owned land, that the land acquired, the land in the section, there is a directed to state-owned land, but I would like the clarification. I don't want it to be vague in any way. I would prefer that just stay in the statute as it is, just to be sure that it does exclude privately owned land in the Mendenhall Wetlands Wildlife.
Representative Josephson?
Well, to expedite this, we don't think that this language impacts anything because it's redundant. And we'll leave it to the committee. I mean, the Mendenhall Wetlands Refuge is state-owned land, and so the language is about state-owned land and, by definition, not privately owned land. If it said excluding privately owned land, if anything, that might create a little curiosity in the reader, because they might think, well, you said that. But that's, I guess I'm sort of indifferent and would leave it up to the committee.
Representative Sadler?
Thank you. I'm going to ask a question, Mr. Meehan. If you could, Mr. Meehan, please describe for me how much land of what land were you describing in the page 20, lines 27 to, I'll just say as far as 31, the Mendenhall Wetlands State Game Refuge is currently identified. How much land is that, and how much privately land is in there? I'd go to the maps, but I don't know if I can find it.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, there is quite a bit of privately owned land in the Mendenhall Wetland State Game Refuge, primarily due to accretion and subsidence. And when that happens, the original refuge boundary was defined as mean high tide. And as that land actually rebounds, I correct myself, as this land is rebounding from glacier melt, the private uplands property owner can claim those wetlands that used to be below mean high tide and are now above it. And the landowners are doing that and are in private ownership. There's also the Southeast Alaska Land Trust that is working with a lot of those landowners to purchase, to subdivide and purchase those lands from the rebound, some of which have been donated back to the state, and that's the subject of the land addition for that provision in the bill. I don't have a number of parcels or acreage for you, but I can say just based on the maps, it's quite a few.
Okay. With that, I remove my objection.
Actually, can I ask a follow-up question?
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. You said that, I think, I'm not sure which land trust it is, you said is buying that accreted land, and is it giving to the state or selling it to the state? I just wanted to probe that. It was kind of an interesting dynamic or interesting transaction.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, at least one parcel, the one that's subject to this bill, has been transferred from the land trust to the state. They currently do hold a number of parcels that they've purchased. I can't say what their ultimate goal is for those, but I know they've been in discussions over the years to transfer those to state ownership.
I mean, is transfer imply sale or gift?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I can't comment on that. I'm not sure.
Okay,
my objection was removed. Amendment, wait, hold on a second. Amendment 12.
Yeah.
Has passed. Next, we're on Amendment 13, H.28 by Representative Colomb.
I move Amendment 13.
Object for the purposes of discussion.
So Amendment 13 is on page 1 at the beginning of the bill. It's a legislative intent. I know that there was a lot of discussions around another bill that had legislative intent, and it was said many times that this was not best practice. Ledge Legal doesn't like it. I believe we kept that in the other bill. But besides that, my pause for concern in the legislative intent is the uniformly managed part. So it's the intent of the legislature that the state's existing game refuges, sanctuaries, fish and game critical habitat areas be uniformly managed as wildlife refuges and sanctuaries. I'm not really sure what that implies. I don't think that all areas should be managed uniformly. And so I think it's an unnecessary section of the bill. And I don't really think the wording of the intent is very clear either. So the amendment removes the legislative intent.
Thank you, Representative Colomb. Representative Josephson?
We oppose this amendment. I think Mr. Meehan is best positioned to describe.
Mr. Meehan.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair. This might be a question for LEG Legal, but in my reading and interpretation of that is that the refuges in critical habitat areas managed as wildlife refuges and the sanctuaries managed as sanctuaries, not that refuges are managed as sanctuaries. I can see there is a little confusion in that statement, but it might be a legal interpretation on what exactly that means. I'd also like to point out that if this amendment was adopted, it could add confusion to the rest of the bill in renaming the critical habitat areas and game refuges as wildlife refuges. So I think in context with the intent and the rest of the bill, it's clear what is being proposed.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. We unfortunately do not have Ledge Legal online for questions, but Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Yeah, with a bill of this length and scope and breadth, I'm a little concerned about having broadly applying intent language. I got to say, it's not this legislator's intent that the state's existing refuges, sanctuaries, and critical habitat areas be uniformly managed as refuges and sanctuaries. I think we've heard clearly that intent language does not really bind anyone to do anything. It's kind of spin. I don't mean spin in a bad sense. It's like spin on a pool board or body English. So I do not feel comfortable having this intent language making such a broad intent. So I like the amendment.
Madam Chair, if I might, this language, and I know you all know that, would not appear if the bill passed in the blue books. It would appear in the beige books, which are the acts or session laws of Alaska, they're called. So in a legal dispute, someone could say, oh, let's look at the entire act as passed, and that's where it would have relevancy. It would help explain why this reform was made.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, do you have wrap-up, Representative Colom?
No, I think I said what I need to.
Okay. I maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Prox?
Yes.
Representative Hall?
No.
Representative Colom?
Yes.
Representative Mears?
No.
Representative Elam?
Yes.
Representative Fields?
No.
Representative Sadler?
Yes.
Co-Chair Dibert?
No.
Co-Chair Freer?
No.
4 yeas, 5 nays.
With a vote of 4 yeas and 5 nays, Amendment 13 is not adopted. Next, I've got Amendment Number 14, H.27 by Representative Colom.
Yes, Chair. I'm going to withdraw Amendment 14, 15, and 16.
Okay. That leaves us at Amendment Number 17, H.22 by Representative Colom.
Did you say 22?
H.22.
Yeah. Okay. I move Amendment 17.
I object for the purposes of discussion.
All right. So Amendment 17 is on page 4. I would say Section 6 is the most important part of the bill. It's defining what a wildlife refuge is. And so in the bill, The definition of game refuge and critical habitat has been combined. And so through the hearings and what's been said, we know that critical habitat areas have a stricter use on usage, or guidelines on use in their areas than a game refuge does. And so when you combine the two, if it's a game refuge now, it's getting stricter on use. If it's a critical habitat now, technically it could be getting a little looser on use. Combining the two and making it a wildlife refuge, I didn't feel like just combining the two gave a good balance between conserving the habitat and keeping access to these lands. And so what my amendment does is it takes the words protect and preserve and use conserve instead. And it deletes the last part of the sentence to restrict all other uses not compatible with that with the purposes. I know there's a disagreement here. I'm looking for more of a balance, making sure access is there. They're still conserving natural habitat, fish and wildlife populations, but it kind of mitigates, to me, brings it down a little bit more into the middle. Where we're not seeing a lot of restriction on access to some of these lands. If you're taking game refuge and you're putting the definition of a critical habitat, that it does have effect on use and access. And so this was my attempt to try to kind of mitigate the two.
Thank you, Representative Klum. Representative Josephson.
We oppose the amendment. I'd ask Mr. Meehan to speak to it, but I will say that the main concern, the more I've thought about this and talked to Mr. Meehan about it and reviewed this, is to put use on equal footing with habitat, for example, and that's one of the, I think, impacts of this amendment, could impact the habitat such that the use wouldn't have much value anymore. So the concern is that we want people to access fish and wildlife and game and to hunt and fish. But you got to protect the habitat to do it. And so I think in melding these together, the goal wasn't to add or subtract. It was to refine. And so those are the main concerns. I'd ask Mr. Meehan to otherwise elaborate on that.
Mr. Meehan?
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair. I would agree. The two provisions of this amendment changing protect and preserve to conserve does lower the intent of protecting, maintaining habitats as opposed to conserve, which is a slightly lower bar for protecting habitats. And that's the main purpose of setting these areas aside in the first place, is to maintain their habitats. The second part of this amendment would add the use of fish and wildlife as one of the primary purposes of the area. And it's basically putting maintaining, protecting, preserving the habitat on equal footing with uses, which uses could damage that habitat. But if they're on equal footing, then in the end, the habitat it could potentially be degraded.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. Representative Sadler?
Thank you, and I appreciate that Mr. Meehan acknowledges the importance of the language we have here. You know, for one thing, we have hundreds of millions of acres of federal wilderness in the state of Alaska, where the animals, birds, fish, wildlife can prosper, can have their lives, and so forth. Interestingly enough, I had a meeting, about an hour-long meeting, with Co-Chair Dybert's intern about legislative policy and how it affects conservation and protection and so forth. One of the things I told Ms. Emma is that there's a difference between conservation and preservation. I think that the preservationist wants to keep things as they are, and a conservationist mm-hmm. wants to use them while protecting them as well. And I think that given the balance between wilderness protection at the federal level and the state's mandate to develop and use our resources for the benefit of the people, the word conserve is much more appropriate when it comes to the underlying purpose of these refuges and sanctuaries. So I really think that this is a very important philosophical and effective amendment that's going to respect the desire and need of Alaskans to use their resources while protecting them, while conserving them, without locking them up unnecessarily. So I really think this is a good amendment, and I really hope the amendment passes.
Madam Chair, if I could, just to clarify. So Representative Sadler, with respect, said that to use protect and preserve could lock up resources. My understanding, and Mr. Meehan can clarify, is that in refuges right now, those words are used. So we're not trying to move that goalpost. It is in existence now.
Representative Sadler?
But we are conflating in this bill refuges and game sanctuaries. We're collapsing into stuff. So that very well may be true, absolutely. But the intent of the collapse and the imposition of protective reserve over the combined definitions has a effect which I do not agree with.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative
Clark? I just respond to that, too. Yeah, it's already in statute. That is the definition of the refuge. But you've added the critical habitat, restricting all other uses not compatible with the purpose. Yeah. That's important. So that's why conserving doesn't mean you get to just kill the habitat. It means you allow uses to the point where you can still conserve the habitat. Protect and preserve means keep basically what Sadler was saying, keeping everything as is. It's doesn't feel like a big difference, but it's actually a big difference.
Yeah.
Representative Sadler.
Yeah, Madam Chair, at the risk of at some risk, I've seen a lot of amendments come up and go down, and we may see more of those, but I really sincerely think this is a very important distinction. I think this is a critical amendment that really needs to pass. I really do.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Do you have any wrap-up comments, Representative Clome?
Just one. I don't think I described part of it. I think Mr. Meehan mentioned it. One of the other things I add is and their uses. So my amendment would say are to conserve natural habitats, fish and wildlife populations, and areas crucial to the perpetuation of fish and wildlife and their uses. And then it drops the restricting all other uses not compatible. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you, Representative Clum. I maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll on amendment number 17?
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Hall.
No.
Representative Fields. No. Representative Clum.
Yes.
Representative Mears.
No.
Representative Elam.
Yes.
Co-Chair Dibert.
No.
Co-Chair Freer.
No.
4 yeas, 5 nays.
With a vote of 4 yeas and 5 nays, amendment number 17 will not be adopted. Next, we have amendment number 18, H.23, by Representative Colomb.
I move amendment 18.
I object for the purposes of discussion.
Amendment 18 is on the same page, actually the line below on line 6. So in the CS, there was a small change, seemed like a small change from shall to may. And so this reverses that change. So this is in the sentence and context, it says the department may allow hunting, trapping, fishing, subsistence, and it lists the photography, recreation. In my view, when you move shall to may, that gives a lot of discretion for the department, and I want the department to, it should be shall allow to make sure we have that balance of hunting, trapping, fishing, subsistence activities, photography. I thought the original language was better, and so this is to revert it back to shall from may.
Thank you, Representative Clum. Representative Josephson?
We maintain our objection, and I would note that, as I understand it, this amendment is I hate to use the word, but it's more extreme than the previous amendment, because it would put a protection of habitat and fish and wildlife populations secondary to public use. So public use would always come first, and protection of habitat second. And that's a real reform not intended by the bill at all. It's germane to the bill. It's just not where the bill is headed, and we oppose it.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Representative Sadler?
Thank you. The bill, as written, conditions permission to use hunting, trapping, fishing, subsistence activities, photography, et cetera, to uses that are let's see, subject to A, use is not compatible with these purposes. So if you interpret any of those activities, fishing, hunting, subsistence, as not compatible with preservation of natural habitats, that is a loophole. It just says they can shut it all down if they want to. And I'm also concerned about the change in strength of this language to go from shall, the department shall allow these things, to they may, as long as it doesn't. I don't like that. It's yet another way when this bill is making some substantive policy changes.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Can I respond to
Representative Colomb?
Or did somebody else? So as far as saying it's restricted, well, it was in the original bill, but we did not change the purpose statement. It's already restrictive. We're already trying to restrict usage. So this isn't going to change. All this is trying to balance the first section of it. I mean, if you want to create wildlife refuges where people can't hunt and fish and you're going to make it really hard for them to do that, I guess you can do that. But this is there's no change above. It's already restricting everything. So changing it from may to shall is like one last ditch effort to try to protect our access to the environment.
Thank you, Representative Clove. Mr. Meehan?
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair. Just to add a couple more points. First of all, this Section B is new. It's not currently in statute. And we wanted to add something into the purpose statement that clearly stated that these activities, the intent is to maintain them in these areas. And again, this is new. This is not in existing statute. We did originally put shall in there, but then some of the feedback we had gotten was that we don't want to be telling the department necessarily that they have to allow all these things. Hunting, trapping, fishing is at the discretion of the boards. And so the department can't necessarily allow those activities if the board has prohibited them or otherwise regulated them. And in some areas, some of these activities may not be appropriate. And it by using the word may, it gives the department the discretion to regulate it where they deem appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. Representative Sadler?
In amendment after amendment, we are eliminating the department's ability to practice discretion by imposing a legislative mandate. So now suddenly we want to give the department discretion? My head's spinning just a little bit.
Thank you, Representative Sather. Mr. Meehan.
Madam Co-Chair. One other point I meant to make, and Representative Josephson hit upon this, is this amendment would make public use a higher priority in these areas than protecting of habitat. My analogy would be as if my public use was to go hunt on a hillside, and the best way to get there was to run up a salmon stream with my ATV through spawning beds. That use would have priority over protecting those spawning beds. So we set aside these areas for the protection of the habitat. A public use should maintain that habitat, not take priority.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. Is there further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Elam.
Thank you. I appreciate the dialogue and the conversation. One of the things that's really important to many of the people here on the Kenai Peninsula is access. And oftentimes we have very limited abilities to be able to get in and out of places. And with Alaska being a state the size that it is, we have concerns with, hiking trails being designated as no motor vehicle access, or ATVs or snow machines, and everything seems to kind of conflict with everything. And so anything that allows greater access to our area in a way that would be responsible, and I think that the department would be able to help maintain some of that responsibility of access. I do have to support those areas because access is so incredibly difficult here in Alaska, and so for those purposes, I'll be supporting this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Elam. Representative Colomb, do you have wrap up?
Yeah. So I will highly disagree that this puts a higher priority to uses. In the sentence above it, it says to restrict all other uses not compatible with this purpose. There's nothing in this section prioritizing use. We are prioritizing protecting and preserving habitats, even if you move that, even if you put for me to shell.
it's still an uphill climb to keep access.
Thank you. With that, I maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll on amendment number 18?
Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Hall.
No.
Representative Elam.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Cologne.
Yes.
Representative Mears.
No.
Co-Chair Dibert.
No.
Co-Chair Freer.
No.
4 yeas, 5 nays.
With a vote of 4 yeas and 5 nays, amendment number 18 is not adopted. Next we have amendment number 19, H.12. By Representative Clome.
I move Amendment 19.
Object for the purposes of discussion.
So Amendment 19 is really long, but it's a pretty simple amendment. So throughout the bill, it has a sentence that says, and land and water acquired in the future by the state within the described area. And so what this is saying is if the state acquires some land within a refuge, they don't have to come back to us and try to get it in the refuge. Automatically, they can put it in the refuge. I know that there is current statute with this language. I didn't change what was already there. What I'm trying to stop is the creep. I think it's important that we know what's in the refuge and the land because of all the discussions we're having today about access and status of these lands. I don't want to bind future biologists and future legislators to just incorporate land as it comes to us. I think it's important that it comes to the legislature. We look at it, and if we want to approve the land into the refuge, great. But I have a real problem, say, you know, putting into the future everything and anything we could acquire, we would just automatically go into the refuge. It basically grows refuges without any legislative oversight.
Thank you, Representative Clome. Representative Josephson?
We object to this, and as I understand it, and this refers to the maps that we had prepared for you, the boundaries or borders of these conservation units are not expanding. Instead, there are gaps in them where there are new additions that have been folded in and are currently being managed by Fish and Game as if they were officially part of that refuge or sanctuary, but they're not going beyond the borders of those. They're just additions to those borders. And so what we're asking for in the bill is to not have to come back every year for this, as if this was a royalty in kind bill, for example, where you've got one of these things every year. Mr. Meehan would know how many additions there are, and we just think that that are being folded in according to the bill, like Creamer's Field, for example, where the university turned over lands to, I assume, DNR for DFNG to manage, and so that's what this is. One could be comforted that the borders themselves are not expanded. It's land within the borders. And if Mr. Meehan wants to clarify anything on that.
Mr. Meehan?
Madam Co-Chair, I don't really have anything more to add to it, but it is just adding lands within the external boundary, not lands external to the boundary.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, if assume a checkerboard pattern of land, whether you're expanding the outside boundary of that checkerboard land is not really as important as whether you're expanding the actual total number of acreage. And, you know, we as the legislature are collectively the stewards of our common land and water resources. It is our responsibility to decide whether increasing the total acreage of a refuge or a sanctuary is good public policy or not. The parallel was drawn about the royalty in kind, royalty in value. That is not automatically done under any assumption that one policy direction or not is the best for the state. It comes back to us to make that decision. Sometimes it's pro forma, sometimes it picks up riders, but that's our decision. So this bill's setting up an automatic expansion of the total number of acreage in refuges is abrogation of our legislative stewardship responsibility. And on that grounds, I oppose it. So therefore, I support the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Sather. Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Josephson. I just want to clarify. So we're talking about here, boundaries are set. This would just be acquisition of any inholdings that are currently private, acquired by the state. Anything that is outside of those existing boundaries, either acquired land, rebounded land, accreted land, anything like that, including a number of the cleanups that are looking at expansions in this today, still do come back to the legislature. So there is still quite a number of circumstances that are even in front of us today that we will continue need to address as a legislature.
Through the chair, Representative Mears, that's correct.
Thank you. Representative Coulomb, do you have any wrap-up?
Yeah, so I'm not sure I agree with it's just all the boundaries are just set and then we're just filling in a checkerboard. But let's say that's true. I still say, as I guess I'll just repeat what Sadler says, is that I think we have a responsibility to look at that. This does affect how the land is managed and used. And I think it's important for us to see that and see how it affects the local. I think the local people should have a say in it. I don't think it should just automatically get enfolded into the refuge.
Thank you, Representative Coulomb. With that, I maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll on amendment number 19?
Representative Mears.
No.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Elam.
Yes.
Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Coulomb.
Yes.
Representative Hall.
No.
Co-Chair Dibert. Co-Chair Freer.
No.
Four yeas, five nays.
With a vote of four yeas and five nays, amendment number 19 is not adopted. Amendment number 20, H.18 by Representative Cole.
I move amendment 20.
Object for the purposes of discussion.
So this removes section 51 of the bill. It's on page 39. Bottom of page 39. So this is a new section. It's not a new subsection. This is a lot of red tape that is not currently in statute that I'm aware of. So when a board determines that the following information is required for particular use of land and water within a refuge, the board shall instruct the commissioner in a letter of acknowledgement to require the person or governmental agency to submit full plans for the use, full plans and specifications for construction work, complete plans and specifications for proper protection of fish and game, the approximate date, and shall require the person or agency to obtain written approval of the commissioner as to the sufficiency of the plans. I guess if you have land within the refuge, this would require you going to the state and getting approval for that. If the department, let's say, Fish and Game wants to build a cabin, or I think there's cabins in McNeil, they want to build a park bench, whatever they want to do in there, they're going to have to go through this scenario every time now. I don't think that's necessary, and I think it's a lot of red tape. It's also pulling the board maybe into to areas that maybe they wouldn't be involved in before. So the amendment just removes that section of the bill, 51, from the bill.
Thank you, Representative Colom. Representative Josephson?
We oppose this, and I think it's important that the committee understand that currently in law, there's AS 1620.530 on submission of plans and specifications in the critical habitat area statute. Well, since we're changing the name of critical habitat areas and we're sort of ending them, not their values, not their principles, but ending the designation called a critical habitat area, we are effectively cutting and pasting this into the bill. So there would still be submission of plans and specifications. Now, that's what Representative Colom objects to. And I understand that she wants to make the reform here, but we're actually not making the reform. We're keeping the status quo. The concern I would have is if you don't authorize the Department of Fish and Game to issue permits for items listed there in 1620.530, then they may not be able to issue any permits at all. So you could actually tie their hands, and they'd say, well, you can't do anything, Mr. Landowner, because, you know, we just don't have any permit power. And so I don't think you really want that repealed.
Mm-hmm. Can I respond to that?
Representative Klum?
This illustrates the problem with combining game refuge with critical wetlands. So now they're all, whether a game refuge or critical habitat, now you're going to have to go through the scenario that a game refuge wouldn't have to go before. Now they do. That's the problem. And he's not wrong. This is in there, but it was only with this designated area. Now we got all these areas that are going to have to do that, which, again, is why I have a problem with the definition of a wildlife refuge.
I think Mr. Meehan?
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair. To clarify further, so again, as Representative Josephson said, this is simply renumbering an existing statute because of the combining of the refuges in critical habitat areas. And there's an almost identical statute already on the books that deals with refuges. So it's all in there. This is really nothing new, either for refuges or critical habitat areas. And it is what gives the department the permitting authority for special area permits, regardless of what the activity in the refuge might be. It gives them the authority to regulate that. And actually, I should correct something. It gives the boards the direction, but the boards have delegated that authority back to the commissioner. And so that's why the boards don't get involved with permitting land use activities in refuges or critical habitat areas.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have not spent my career in this area, as Mr. Meehan has, so I cannot speak with the alacrity and precision that he does. But my concern is, I'm going to call this kind of person an inholder, a person who has private property inside a wildlife refuge. So my point is that combining two different categories of land into one and then applying the conditions that apply to one to both and implying that is no change, I don't know what that is, but it doesn't quite rock with me. This is the requirement for a private landholder to receive permission and provide notice to the commissioner is a mother may I in the vernacular here. I understand that private inholdings are a challenge for land managers, and it would be easier for the government managers that they would simply go away. I understand that's difficult. But requiring notice to the commissioner and getting commissioner's approval represents a kind of taking. It just makes enjoyment and use of that private land more difficult. I don't see any provisions for compensation for the taking. And if you think I'm using taking inappropriately, remember the Marine Mammal Protection Act says getting within X number of feet of a whale is taking of that marine mammal. So this represents a taking of the usufruct, the use of that land, and again represents one more area in which this bill is an incremental lean towards government control of land in Alaska, including private property. I can't support that, so therefore I support the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Madam Chair.
Representative Elam.
Thank you. I think that this amendment, along with a series of other amendments, have kind of highlighted sort of that I think we might need to have some further conversations potentially around private land versus, you know, sort of some of the intent of some of the original statute that's here? Because I think that a lot of this is actually, we have some really large private landholders throughout the state, and I think this might have some impacts on some of those. The bill itself, I support the amendment, and I think the amendment might be highlighting some of that. Just as we're having this conversation, we just have a lot of land that are privately held, and it does seem kind of interesting that here in Alaska, where very few private individuals like myself or even any of us on the committee, we only own just small pieces of land. I mean, I don't know everybody's land holdings and stuff, but by comparison to some of these really large areas of private land, and so I think some of these laws that are currently in statute, when we start tweaking these laws, it's going to have some impacts in some of those other areas. And I guess I would just say to the bill sponsor, have you looked at what the larger ramifications might be to some of these larger landholders?
Mr. Meehan?
Yeah, Madam Chair, to add some more clarity to this, our bill, again, defines existing refuges and existing critical habitat areas that we're renaming refuges to include state-owned lands only. So the two statutes, the one for existing refuges and this particular one, which is moving over from critical habitat areas, are only applicable on state-owned lands within the boundaries of what we're now calling refuges. And we purposely did that to exclude the authority, of Fish and Game Land Management Authority over private lands in both the existing refuges and critical habitat areas that we're now proposing to call refuges. And that's especially important with four of the Bristol Bay Area critical habitat areas that have large tracts of Native Corporation lands and Native allotment lands in them. We didn't think it was appropriate, and I know that Fish and Game over history has not wanted to permit activities, particularly on those Native Corporation lands. And so that avoids this very issue that we're talking about, private lands.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up, Representative Elam.
So is there anybody available who can tell me what kind of impacts the proposed changes would be versus what the impacts might be to those private lands with the proposal from the amendment here?
Thank you, Representative Elam. Unfortunately, with this late hour, we lost the Department of Fish and Game, Department of Law, and Ledge Legal. So you've got okay. Mr. Meehan.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. I don't mean to put you on the spot here. I can do some more digging into it afterwards. I suspect I know how this amendment's going to go. But if you would take a shake at it, maybe just, well, you've already told, you've explained me. Thank you. I appreciate the insight.
Thank you, Representative Elam. Did you have, Representative Prox?
Yeah, thank you. This one I have to ask. I just don't know the status of these lands well enough, but in the Minto Flats is a game refuge, I believe, and then I guess I wouldn't be surprised if Doyon or Minto Village Corporation or somebody had inholdings within that, and then also in the Yukon Flats area, same thing. There's a lot of Native Corporation land up there. Will this, what you're proposing initially, affect those lands? Because this seems to predict some situations like that.
Through the co-chair, Representative Prox, first of all, Yukon Flats is a federal refuge, so this would not influence that refuge in those lands whatsoever. For Minto Flats, which, yes, is a current state game refuge, I can't say from recollection if there are large tracts of native corporation surface. They may very well have lots of subsurface rights there. And I do believe there are a number of native allotments in Minto Flats. And currently with refuges, refuges only include state-owned land. So even those native allotments currently are not managed or have any oversight by Fish and Game because they're privately held.
Does that answer your question, Representative Brooks?
I think as good as we can.
Thank you.
I might need to make a phone call.
Representative Colomb, do you have any wrap-up?
Yeah, I just have one wrap-up. So I'm aware that it only affects state-owned land. But we've heard several times where a conservation group can buy some land and donate it to the state. The university has some land, gives it to the state. You can get around the privately owned land if you have enough money. You can buy it. And then and this says in the future, you don't even have to tell the legislature. They can just start buying up land around the refuges. And this says it can be incorporated. Any little piece that maybe a private owner has, you just get somebody to go buy that and give it to the state. So, yes, it does right now. It says only state-owned land, but that can easily be get around, especially with the future statements in here. So that's all I had to say.
Thank you, Representative Colomb. I maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Hall.
No.
Representative Mears.
No.
Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Colomb.
Yes.
Representative Elam.
Yes.
Co-Chair Dibert.
No.
Co-Chair Freer.
No.
Four yeas, five nays.
With a vote of four yeas and five nays, amendment number 20 is not adopted. Next we have amendment number 21, H.14 by Representative Colomb.
I move amendment number 21.
Object for the purposes of discussion.
So amendment 21, actually I'm putting forward for some of my colleagues around Palmer and the Valley. It removes the Palmer Hay Flats totally from the bill. Their issue is that if you wanted to incorporate those few sections in the Palmer Hay Flats to complete your checkerboard, they would be okay if it was still a game refuge. They don't want to do that under the definition of a wildlife refuge. It is a very it's a big waterfowl and moose hunting area. And so I told them I would put this forward to remove the Palmer Hay Flats change, and it would remain as it is now.
Representative Josephson?
Yes, we oppose the amendment. You know, I think that the net benefit to users, both duck hunters, other hunters, would be greater by including these segments. In other words, you would have fewer competitive uses and development that would impact those recreational interests. And I know that the Friends of Palmer Hay Flats is supportive of this. There's a letter that you may, I hope, have in your stack. And these have come into possession of DNR and should be included.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Is there any further discussion?
Can I do a wrap-up?
Wrap-up, Representative?
Well, since we haven't changed the definition of a wildlife refuge, it would not help increase the usage. It will restrict the usage. We've already defined that. It puts the habitat protect and preserve clause on top of that. So it's clearly the use is very secondary. This is used by a lot of hunters. And
to the Palmer Hay Flats and the people that called in, the few people that did call in, I would say this is a pretty complicated bill. I've talked to the Waterfowl Association. They did not realize or understand the impact of the bill. They read it, but there's a lot. It's almost an 80-page bill. And so it's sometimes they don't understand the impact to the usage of the areas. And so if the hay flats stay in there, it will go under the definition of a wildlife refuge, which will restrict some access and usage.
Thank you, Representative Coulombe. I'm going to maintain my objection on amendment number 21. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Elam.
Yes.
Representative Hall.
No.
Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Mears.
No.
Representative Coulombe.
Yes.
Co-Chair Dibert.
No.
Co-Chair Freer?
No.
4 yeas, 5 nays.
The vote of 4 yeas and 5 nays, amendment number 21 is not adopted. I've got amendment number 22, H.16 by Representative Coulombe.
I move amendment number 22.
Object for the purposes of discussion.
So 22, similar to the prior amendment, I had a colleague that was concerned about Creamer's Field going under this definition of a wildlife refuge. If they wanted to put it into a game refuge, they were okay. They do not like the new definition of the wildlife refuge. They have concerns around access and use, and so this amendment just takes the proposal on Creamer's Field out of the bill and keeps it the way it is.
Thank you, Representative Coulombe. Representative Josephson.
We oppose the amendment. Under Governor Parnell, one of the first bills involving Creamer's Field that I saw, there's been another one since, because due to an error in the bill, a technical error, then Governor Parnell had to veto it. But Governor Parnell was actually Representative Wohl's bill, but there was bipartisan support for expanding Creamer's Field. And looking at this map now, this is land that has been given to the state or sold to the state for purposes of the field's migratory waterfowl protection. There is other recreational interests there that no doubt would like to see it maintained as a refuge, because they enjoy that, and they include snow machiners and dog mushers, I'm told. And so we oppose the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to say this with a smile. I mean, there's a little bit of lightheartedness. So I'm not sure if the Masons' prohibition to us on referring to the governor to seek to influence a vote extends to past governors or not. So I would ask the attorney in the room to give us a ruling on that. But that's
Representative Josephson.
No, I'm not going in those waters.
His ruling is no.
Mr. Meehan.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, I just have one more thing to add, is that this parcel was actually purchased using Department of Fish and Game funds, Pittman-Robertson funds, and then community donations.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. Seeing no further discussion, do you have any... Representative Prox. Thank you.
Well, this is kind of a specific case that I'm familiar with, and I guess it was just my opinion that the refuge and laws and confusion surrounding that was used inappropriately to prohibit somebody that was making an effort to develop that in a way, for a commercial purpose, and that was the objection, but something that would have benefited the community. And it's kind of a case in point where you got to be careful about locking down state land, or even owning state land, I guess. So anyway, support the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Prox. Do you have any wrap-up comments, Representative Klum?
Just to say that the comments about everybody supporting it is so great. The problem is you're changing the definition. It's going to be a wildlife refuge. It's going to have different implications than what it is now.
Right.
Thank you, Representative Klum. With that, I do maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Hall.
No.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Mears.
No.
Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Cologne.
Yes.
Representative Elam.
Yes.
Co-chair Dibert.
No.
Co-chair Freer.
No.
Four yeas, five nays.
With a vote of four yeas and five nays, amendment number 22 is not adopted.
Chair, can we do an at ease?
Brief at ease. Back on record in House Resources, Representative Cologne, we have amendment number 24 in front of us.
I will not be offering amendment 24.
Okay, and we just had copied and distributed amendment number, what we're calling amendment number 25, H.32, by Representative Cologne.
I move amendment 25.
And I object for the purposes of discussion.
So I'll read it just because it was, it's not on basis right now, but basically, on page 4, it adds the sentence, nothing in this section prohibits the operation of a shooting range, shooting park, or similar facility operated or sanctioned by the department. The amendment, the wording, actually, I appreciate Mr. Meehan putting this forward. I had tried to figure out a way to protect the shooting park, and it was too narrow, and so I'm using his language and hoping to just put an extra layer of protection over the shooting park and the refuge.
Thank you, Representative Klum. Representative Josephson?
No objection.
Okay, with that, I remove my objection, and amendment number 25, H.32, is adopted. And that brings us that we are done with amendments. Is there further discussion on House Bill 321 as amended?
No.
One country is heard from.
Speak for everyone.
Let me go through my notes.
Let me go through.
Hearing no further discussion, I would like to entertain a motion to move this bill from committee. Representative Co-Chair Dibert, do you have a motion?
I move House Bill 321, Work Order 34-LS1257/N, as amended with technical and conforming changes from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection?
Object.
Would you like to speak to your objection?
I think I've spoke to the objection for about 4 hours. I'm not going to tell anybody about that. I have serious concerns with the bill. I appreciate the work that's been put into it, but it has a lot of serious policy implications, so I will not be removing my objection.
Thank you, Representative Colon. Representative Prox?
Yes, not that we haven't thoroughly considered, but same objection. There is going to be many more objections. This is going to burn up a considerable amount of time, and I think that's going to make it difficult to get through the other body and more than likely make it very difficult to get through the third floor. And I hate to put more committees and the whole House of Representatives through this agony. So I think we should just hang on to it.
Thank you, Representative Prox. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I'm going to echo the concerns voiced by my two preceding speakers. You know, I think there is a couple of good elements of legislation buried inside this 79 pages and 117 sections of law. There's a movie that I watched a lot of years ago called A Bridge Too Far, and I think this is just too much. And as I say, there might be some good parts in here, but I need to resist this, and will vote against passage of this, and anticipate voting against it should it come before us in any form in the next couple or 4 weeks. I'm also concerned about the amount of time and effort and resources we've burned doing this when the prospects for final passage are possibly not that great. So yeah, I look forward to voting no on this one.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. And with Representative Elam being on the phone, he will not be permitted to vote on the actual passage of the moving the bill out of committee. And
Madam Chair?
He's not able to, but we have to restate the motion because we are on a different version. Apologies. Yeah. So... Co-chair.
You can also talk if you want.
We're going to restate the motion. Co-chair Dibert?
Yes. I move House Bill 321, Work Order 34-LS-125-7 /H as amended, with technical and conforming changes from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
And object.
Thank you, Co-Chair Dibert. Thank you for your objection. Representative Elam, did you want to speak?
Yes, thank you. I appreciate being able to talk about it. Even though I can't vote there in person, I would be a no vote on this as well. Much like some of the concerns that were expressed earlier, I appreciate the work and the diligence on the mappings and sort of the intent of some of the work here that's needing to be done, which is why I offered my amendment for trying to preserve the work there specifically in the mapping. But there are a lot of policy nuances that I have concerns with. I have some concerns that it will limit access to areas that are already hard to access or even nearly impossible to access at this point. And so for those reasons, I would be objecting to this. And so, again, I appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak on the bill as amended.
Thank you, Representative Elam. With that, I will ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative Prox.
No.
Representative Colomb.
No.
Representative Hall.
Yes.
Representative Mears.
Yes.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Co-Chair Dibert.
Yes.
Co-Chair Freer?
Yes.
Five yeas, three nays.
And with a vote of 5 yeas and 3 nays, House Bill 321 passes from committee as amended and with technical and conforming changes. Please stick around after we adjourn to sign the committee report, and that finally completes the agenda for our...
It's a good one.
Representative Sadler.
I just want to thank the chair and the sponsor here for sticking with us and for the respectful way you allowed a respectful debate in this bill. It's a big one, a lot of issues, but I really appreciate the good conduct of this committee. Just want to say for the record.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. I really appreciate that.
And I guess I should say the same.
Representative Prox.
I do appreciate the diligence that went into this bill, and I'm sure it was all in good faith. We will see what happens from here.
Thank you, Representative Prox. That completes the agenda for our House Resources Committee meeting today. Our next House Resources Committee meeting will be on Monday, April 20th at 1 p.m., where we will take up confirmations for Julie Vogler to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, followed by the first hearing on Senate Bill 230 related to the Jonesville Public Use Area from Senator Rauscher. The time now is 6:56 p.m., and this hearing of the House Resources Committee is now adjourned.